Peachtree Road. The South killed Lucy Bondurant Chastain Venable on the day she was born. It just took her until now to die. It was a textbook murder, classical in concept, faultless in execution. A work of art, really, as such things go. And no wonder, it's what we do best, kill our women. Or maim them. Or make monsters of them, which may be the worst of all. There were so many Bondurants at Oakland Cemetery this afternoon. Most of them, thank God, safely below ground. My grandmother and grandfather, my great-aunt, a small, sad row of newly born and perished infants, Lucy's small brother Jamie, and above ground, her narrow Ferragamos gleaming in the dust of early October, old Willa Bondurant on the arm of her surviving daughter Adelaide. Little Lady Bondurant Rawson, Lucy's younger sister, the good one, Lucy herself. And me, Shepherd Gibbs Bondurant III, known to almost everyone as Shep or Sheppy, the last Bondurant. Or am I? This is, and will likely always be, the central mystery of my life. Lucy came to live with us in the house on Peachtree Road when she was 5 and I was 7. And before that April day was over, I learned two things that altered almost grotesquely the landscape and weather of my small life. I learned that not all women wept in the nights after the act of love, and I learned that we were rich. That those tidbits of information should literally change a world seems perhaps a bit strange now, when children of 7 digest with equanimity the daily disclosure of the sexual peccadilloes of politicians and television evangelists, and the felonious traffic in billions by arbitrageurs and governments. But the Buckhead and Atlanta of that day were infinitely smaller principalities than now, and my own cosmos within them was minuscule. I literally had nothing with which to compare my life, and so assumed, in the manner of cloistered only children, that everything and everybody else was as we were. I knew that my mother cried at night after having intercourse with my father because I had slept since my infancy in a small room that had been intended as the dressing room for my parents' bedroom. I could not articulate it then, of course, but our house, beautiful and graceful though it was a house of delicate skewedness and aberration. My parents were not clever or active or happy people, did not fit four square into the world they had achieved with red wine, money, and land, and Bondurant guile and acumen. My father, who had been as a boy sublimely content and at home in the rough, hard-drinking, hunting and fishing masculine society that formed Fayetteville, Georgia's small upper crust, was perpetually clumping and red-wristed and truculent in the urban clubs and drawing and dining rooms, which he perceived as a feat. My mother came to think that she had married beneath her, and that the vitality and exuberance that had first won her hand had become the barnacles that weighted her heart and slowed her trajectory through the society of Atlanta. He came to feel that the delicacy and distance and sheen of family substance that had so charmed him had been forged into weapons with which she had cut him off from his kind and kept him isolated at politely hostile club dances and bridge evenings and benefit dinners. She had brought considerable family fortune to their marriage as a dowry, and with part of it, he had bought the house on Peachtree Road and the rural property to the west and north of the city, which, coupled with the wretched downtown holdings her family had bequeathed her, had increased that fortune nearly tenfold. She thought he'd used her shamelessly, and he thought she scorned and failed to appreciate him. Both were right on all counts. It was inevitable that from the beginning, I would be what my mother called sensitive, always seeming to speak the word in capital letters, and my father called sissy. "You're going to make a goddamn preacher of him, Olivia," he'd bellow, when he found me totally immersed in reading my way through the Bible, not comprehending that it was the glorious, plum-tasting language of King James and not the precepts contained within that drew me to the good book. "Always coughing and squinting and fumbling when he tries to play football, puking up his guts when he tries to put a worm on a hook." He's sensitive. That's what he is, Shepherd, my mother would say, brushing the lank comma of white blonde hair that was my father's legacy to me off my forehead. And they were both right. I was both sensitive and a physical coward, being possessed, as many precocious only children are, of a soaring and vivid imagination that could illuminate in excruciating clarity the scope and detail of all the dangers the world was fraught with. But still, I castigated myself bitterly and endlessly, if silently, for failing to like most of the things my companions did and for failing to please my father, the great masculine elemental who towered and roared over my childhood like Red Cronus over the embryo world. And dimly, dimly, I felt the lapping of a futile rage at my mother who had so early doomed me to be sensitive, and at my father who would not, perhaps could not, rescue me from her. And I hated and feared that rage and felt the guilt of it. It was not, for a child, the most nurturing of worlds, even in its unabashed privilege. But oh, the seductiveness, the symmetry, the immutability, the sheer heart-drugging beauty of that world. Especially in those days before it became chic and accessible and throttled with traffic, Buckhead was one of the most beautiful places on earth. That cloistered deep green rectangle of great old trees and winding streets and fine, not-so-old houses set far back on emerald velvet lawns, carved out of deep hardwood forests, cushioned and insulated from the sweat, smells, and cacophony of the city proper to the south by layers of money. No one has ever been quite sure what the official boundaries of Buckhead are, but for many years, my own personal Buckhead was that 4-odd square miles bounded on the south by Peachtree Creek, the north by West Paces Ferry Road, the west by Northside Drive, and the east by Peachtree Road. Peachtree Road. It is to me a name with far more scope and resonance than its dozen or so meandering miles of asphalt should rightly command. The restless, well-heeled floods of people who come to Atlanta each year now to meet and convene and visit and do business think they're seeing Atlanta when they see Peachtree Street, but they are not. Visitors visit on Peachtree Street. Atlanta lives, or did, on and just off Peachtree Road. As little as I love the city now, I still, perversely, and despite what it has become, love Peachtree Road. To me, it encompasses and personifies all that is particular and powerful about the city, as well as all that is abstract and illusory and beautiful. Even its ugliness, and much of it is simply and profoundly ugly, seems to me to be rich, deeply textured, and unique to Atlanta. Admittedly, I see it now through the scrim of childhood, but I do not think it looks like anywhere else on earth. The very name of it rings in my heart like a bell, and still, to my eyes, the most beautiful and singular point on all of Peachtree Road is the house at 2500 where I was born and have lived for the entirety of my life. These, then, were my worlds in that portentous spring that Lucy came to us, the larger world of Buckhead proper and the smaller of 2500 Peachtree Road. When the telegram came in early April from my Aunt Willa Bondurant, saying that Uncle Jim had left them in New Orleans and she had no choice but to come to us and bring her children, it was a cataclysm of enormous proportions, not only to my mother and father, but to me. Whatever my scant status with them, it has, so far at least, been that of only child. The thought of sharing my house and their attention engendered in me a rage so murderous that I could only deal with it as I had learned early to deal with all things that threatened. I shoved it completely out of my mind. Even on the day of their arrival, I was unruffled. I knew absolutely and to the core of me that no alien white trash aunt, my mother's overheard epithet, and cousins would appear in the round foyer of my domain. I could repeat word for word the message that I knew would come soon by telephone or telegram. So sorry, but all your relatives have been killed in an accident and therefore can't come. When the doorbell rang, I pounded downstairs behind my mother to find four figures standing there with the twilight falling down over them, shocking and aberrant to me as murderers or trolls. The first clear thought that struck me was that my Aunt Willa assaulted the eye and nose and ear simultaneously, though not to me unpleasantly. She had hair so black it shone blue and purple in the light over the front door, and she wore garnet lipstick and nail polish, laid on with a trowel, as my mother said to someone over the telephone later that evening, in a low, only half-amused voice. She smelled powerfully of the acrid sweat of travel and nervousness, though this was masked with a friendly, evocative scent that I always associated with Winder and Robert's drugstore at Christmas time. Evening in Paris, a ton of it, my mother further instructed her phone friend. Aunt Willa tottered lamely on towering slingback heels and her toenails were the same dried blood red of her lips and fingernails. I found her powerfully, magically glamorous, there in that dim foyer with its dim old oriental rugs and dim stained stucco walls and dim ornate old gilt-framed paintings of my red wine ancestors. Dim. Suddenly it seemed to me that until these four maniacally unknown people had walked in out of the warm April night to light my foyer into rawness and vitality, my whole seven-year-old life had been dim. I saw next that my aunt held a cherubic little blonde boy of less than a year in the crook of one arm, and by the other hand held an equally angelic little girl of perhaps three, solemn and sweating and overdressed in a fuchsia velvet coat, bonnet, and leggings. Behind her, with one hand on the small girl's shoulder, a girl taller than I, but obviously younger, stood staring directly at me with her mother's extraordinary blue eyes. And something looking out of them flew into and through my own and straight into my heart with a directness and force that felt as though I'd swallowed a fire-tipped arrow. I blinked and gulped soundlessly, like a fish drowning in air, and then, surprising myself profoundly, grinned. The girl grinned back. Her hair was the pure, clear dark of cold winter creek water over fallen leaves, and it flew loosely around her narrow head like corn silk. Her lashes were sooty cobwebs on her pink-flushed cheeks, and she was tall and willowy like her mother, with long limbs and small hands and feet and a whippet waist. She was standing still, but she looked as if she'd been in motion all over and had just settled to earth. She was 5 years old and wore corduroy overalls and dirty saddle shoes. "Something stinks," she said in a voice that was slow and rich like music, like dark honey. "Lucy," my Aunt Willa said, scandalized. She had a flat nasal drawl. My parents looked at each other and then at the girl. "Sure does," I said back, joy caroling inexplicably in my veins. "It's Martha in the kitchen. She's cooking lamb for our dinner tonight." "Smells like she's cooking dog," Lucy Bondurant said, and laughed a dark silk banner of a laugh. And I laughed, and even when the adults had made us both apologize and sent us upstairs to the screened porch to calm down until you can act like a lady and a gentleman, we continued to laugh. It was the first real laughter I could remember in the house on Peachtree Road. It was the first, last, and longest thing I had and kept of Lucy, her laugh. When we had stopped laughing, she said, "Are you all the children there are?" "Yes," I said, somehow ashamed of it. "I guess she must not have liked it when your daddy got on her then," Lucy said matter-of-factly. "What do you mean?" "Well, my mama used to laugh and holler when daddy got on her, and there's three of us. There's just one of you, so I guess your mama didn't like it and quit doing it, or there'd be more of you." "She didn't quit," I said. "He gets on her all the time, but she doesn't laugh. She cries. She cries almost every night. I know, because I slept right in her room." "What for?" she said. "Why don't you have a room of your own, as rich as y'all are?" "Rich?" I said, stupidly. "Sure. Why do you think we came all the way down here? Now we're going to be rich, too." It was too much. Too much of suddenness and strangeness and revelation. Too much of a promise. My stomach heaved and flopped, and I ran for the bathroom and was sick. I was still queasy and spinning when my mother came up to telephone her friends and tell them about the invasion of the infidels. It was a long time late before I slept. But I did sleep, finally. Slept that night in a different country, one where we were rich and therefore different from other people, and in which women laughed and shouted aloud their pleasure during the act of love. A country where now Lucy was, and therefore all things might be possible. I slept in a safe child, sudden and simple, lightless peace, and when I awoke in the morning, it was to joy.
Lucy and Shep quickly became inseparable. They soon claimed the summer house, a small house behind the big one, as their refuge, and they fiercely guarded it against intruders.
The summer house. Always to me, and then to Lucy, it was sheer enchantment, a place apart both in distance and in spirit, with the utter and endless fascination that all perfect miniature things have for children. It was a complete small house, a near replica of the big one, except that it was done in white frame, with the same hipped roof, black shuttered Palladian windows to the floor, and a pedimented columned portico. It was buried in a surf of old boxwoods and crepe myrtles, and backed by dense woods, and a wisteria vine arched over the portico and bathed the two big rooms inside in a wash of lavender light and fragrance each spring. There was one great room for living and dining, floored in Italian quarry tiles and with a small stone fireplace, and a smaller one adjoining it for sleeping and dressing. Behind these rooms were a small bath and a complete compact kitchen. It had been built for my grandmother Adelaide, who came to live with her son and daughter-in-law when my grandfather died, before I was born. But she lived in it for only 2 years before she too died. It was largely unused until Lucy and I claimed it and moved our daytime base of operations there. My parents and her mother did not really mind. The furnishings were too grand for the servants, who in any case had quarters over the garage, and not grand enough for use in entertaining. They had not been in the house a week before it became apparent to me, my sponge-like pores newly opened to revelation, that my Uncle Jim was to loom over Lucy's life, and therefore mine, like one of those menacing grotesques in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. Around 4 o'clock in the afternoon of the fifth day they had been with us, Martha Cater, our maid, put her head into my newly acquired third-floor cubicle, where I was just yawning my way out of an enforced nap, and asked if I knew where Lucy was. I did not. No one downstairs had seen her either, and a quick search of the immediate back garden did not turn her up. I rifled aside bushes and vines and walked through each room of the summer house. "You ought to come out now," I said aloud, for I felt sure that Lucy was somewhere in the vicinity of the summer house. "You're really going to be in the soup if my father gets mad at you." But there was no answer, and my own voice in my ears frightened me somehow, and I did not call again. I went back to the house in defeat. It was full dark, and my father was on his way to the telephone to call the police when Lucy came drifting up from the garden, hair wild and caught with bits of leaf trash and eyes smoke dark and large. Even in the green darkness, I could see the white sweetness of her smile. When Aunt Willa had finished spanking her and let her hands fall, breathing hard, Lucy looked up at her, white-faced and dry-eyed, and said, "Will you hug me now, Mama?" "Of course I won't hug you," Aunt Willa shrilled. "You've been an awfully bad girl, like to scare us all to death. Your Uncle Shepherd out in the car looking all over for you, and dinner ruined. Bad girls like you don't deserve hugs."
"Daddy hugged me all the time," Lucy said, more to me, hovering in the background than to her furious mother.
"No, he didn't," Willa said. "He never did hug you. You always were a bad girl. He never did hug you one single time. He hit you, that's what he did. You were so bad he hit you every time he turned around."
Lucy cried then. Her blue eyes slit shut in anguish, and her hands flew to her mouth.
"Not any more than he hit you," she cried, whirling away from us. "Hit you lots more than he did me."
"Lucy!"
Aunt Willa shrieked. But Lucy was going up the stairs into the dimness of the second floor. I could not look at my Aunt Willa's mottled, dull red face, so I looked at my father. He grimaced in distaste. I looked at my mother. Incredibly, she was smiling a full, slow smile. I had not seen that smile in nearly a week. She laid one slim hand on my Aunt Willa's arm.
"Come on up to my room with me, Willa," she said in her slow Atlanta accent. "I've a few things in my closet that I never wear anymore. I think they look awfully pretty on you. Martha will see to Lucy."
Only then did I look full at my Aunt Willa.
Before the black lashes dropped down, I saw in her eyes a pure and living hate. "Thank you, Olivia," she murmured. A long and terrible symbiosis had begun. I followed Lucy upstairs. "I'll hug you, Lucy," I said. "Do you want me to?" "Please," Lucy said in a small, frail voice. "I need for you too, so I won't fly off the world." This did not sound at all strange to me then, or ominous. I crawled into the bed beside her and put my arms awkwardly around her, and there we stayed, her small bones feeling under my hands like a bird's, until the hammering of her heart slowed and she fell asleep. But I knew even then, though I could not have sculpted the thought, that it was not my arms that Lucy sought. It was those first arms, that vanished phantom's arms. And whether or not what she had said as she slid into sleep was true, never again in all her careening life did she find them. When she had started first grade, her teacher had read the class a snippet of Kipling's The Jungle Book, and Lucy was instantly and utterly captivated. Her face was so incandescent when she told me about small Mowgli, who was saved from starvation and raised by the wolf pack, that I badgered my mother to take us downtown to the Carnegie Library and check the book out. That night, with the aid of a stolen flashlight, I read the book in its entirety to her, and for the rest of that fall, we lived in the enchanted emerald jungle of those pages. Each evening I reread a portion of the book to her until she fell asleep, and after school, in the autumn-gilded honeysuckle thicket behind the summer house, we played endless games of Jungle Book. Lucy sometimes took the role of Bagheera, the sleek black panther, but most of the time she was Mowgli, and she always accorded me the role of Baloo, the great, fierce, protective bear. "We be of one blood, thou and I," Lucy would intone endlessly, in a kind of incantatory sing-song through those warm, vivid afternoons. And when we were separated from each other or met again, we would cry, "Mark my trail, mark my trail." One afternoon, when the cicada buzzing, dry heat of Indian summer had burned so endlessly onto our heads and forearms that we felt time stopped and weightless in a dusty golden void, Lucy unwrapped the ball of her red sweater and pulled out a kitchen paring knife. "Let's really be of one blood," she said. "Let's cut our wrists and bleed in each other so we'll always be blood kin." The mere sight of the knife made me weak and sick. "We are blood kin," I said. "We're first cousins. We couldn't be any closer kin unless we were brothers and sisters." "You know what I mean," Lucy said. I did. "I can't," I said in dull despair. "You have to do it, Gibby," she hissed. "Do it now," she whispered. "Do it. It will mean that we belong to somebody who will come and help us and be with us when we're lonesome and save us from bad things." I did it. With the quickness of sheer desperation, I pressed the blade deep into my wrist where the little blue delta of veins beat as fast as a snared rabbit's, and the pain was as sharp and sickening as the overripe, mashed persimmons on the floor of the woods around us. Lucy grasped my wrist quickly and pressed it to hers, even as the pain and nausea and dizziness flooded my veins and climbed, buzzing, up my arms and flew up to my temples. Nobody noticed the cuts, which were, when cleaned and dried, almost invisible, though severe enough so that we both bore the scars always. Those small, fine white lines on our two wrists became, forever after, brands of ownership and identity. The next book I brought home to Lucy was Sir Thomas Malory's Mort d'Arthur. Like the Jungle Book, it came to hover over our childhoods with such a weight and mass that it in some ways defined us. Where Lucy had been enchanted by the story of the salvation and deliverance of Mowgli, she went down into Malory with a kind of fierce and full-souled affirmation that suggested a water creature finding, at the last moment before suffocating in the blade-sharp air, the depths of his life-giving sea. Somewhere in that string of Thomas Malory days, Lucy gave me my soul, and I knew it. Malory and his tender, foolish, beautiful victims were the gift I gave to her. Sainthood was hers to me. She said it on one of the first nights I read to her from Mallory, that time the story of Lancelot and Guinevere. When I finished, I looked over at her and she was sitting bolt upright, light burning on her face like white fire, color coming and going into it.
"They were always saving ladies back then," she said on a breath of pure joy. "It was the way a knight had to act. He had to. And you're going to be the bravest and handsomest knight of all, always and always, and you always, always save me. I knew you would when we cut our wrists."
The simple salvation of identity roared in my head. I knew then, as I have never really known since, who I was. Shepherd Gibbs Bondurant III, knight. And I gave her the hawk-like grin of a golden Galahad and loved her in my deepest heart. And when I lay in bed that night, I wept silently with the sheer relief of having been given a self. For it was that, in being given and accepting the role of protector to Lucy, all the years of my life as a powerless and completely irrelevant small boy vanished as if they had never been, and what was left was pure and endless power. My obscure and deep buried angers were all right, because they became in that moment the righteous wrath of a saint. All aberrations became divine, because they were the God-bestowed stigmata of a saint. It justified all I was and would become, would do. I would look after Lucy Bondurant and scourge through the world anything that threatened her. Dear Lord, but it was a terrible and seductive boon that she gave me. To a small boy with nothing, the most seductive of all. It kept me enthralled to more than just Lucy for the bulk of my life. It kept me in a saint's sterile, self-imposed exile.
During the summer of 1942, Lucy's baby brother Jamie died of polio. Lucy and Shep were quarantined, forbidden to see even each other. Once the polio scare faded, Shep and Lucy resumed their friendship. They were together constantly, until Lucy led Shep and a band of young boys on a rampage of vandalism through an old deserted mansion. After they were caught, Shep's father forbade him to have anything to do with Lucy, and he swore he would send Lucy's entire family away if his son disobeyed. Shep, 11 years old, was moved out to the summer house, while Lucy remained in the main house, alone in the echoing upstairs rooms. Lucy was forbidden the company of Shep and the boys she had once led, and she would have nothing to do with the girls selected to be her playmates. At Shep's mother's suggestion, Aunt Willa further isolated Lucy by enrolling her in the very strict Miss Beauchamp's school. 9-year-old Lucy's loneliness was eased by the kindness and friendship of the black servants of the household, developing a love and affinity for black people that would last throughout her life.
It was the beginning of my brief time as pure boy in a boy's world, a time I doubt I would have had if it had not been for the punishment and its attendant separation from Lucy. I moved into the last days of my childhood in the company of boys, and made of one of them, Charlie Gentry, the great male friend of my life. That incarceration, and the few years that followed it, contain all I know of the light, clear bonds of masculine friendship. I knew that my father meant what he said about sending them away. The saintly knight still lived in my breast, but his shield was lost and his spear broken. After a while, I laid them down and slipped gratefully into boyhood. My first friend was Ben Cameron, and though the friendship never deepened and smoothed into the mellow, nourishing thing I had with Charlie Gentry, still, it showed me the sheer pleasure of a relationship that lay lightly and was fed without pain from shallow roots. With Ben, the abundance of his flamboyant charm and his dark, glinting, sardonic wit made up for those depths held back. His enthusiasms were many and mercurial. He was a born dancer. Sarah and Dorothy Cameron both used to say that it was a shame ballet dancers were thought to be sissies, because Ben would have been a star and made $1 million at it. He would shrug that off, flushing up to his coppery hairline and laugh. But it was true. In addition to tutoring me in mathematics, Ben gave me one of the great and enduring loves of my life. He let me chomp and hoot around on his clarinet, at which he was as effortlessly proficient as he was at everything else he attempted. And though I never quite achieved his technical virtuosity on it, I was smitten with a passion far stronger than his the instant I picked it up and felt the sweet heft of that ebony cylinder in my hands, and tasted the smoky persimmon taste of the slick-bitten reed. I was hooked before the first mallard-like honks and skirling shrieks came issuing forth from the instrument, and nagged my mother so desperately and tirelessly that within a week I had a shining new clarinet of my own. The other friend of my boyhood, and indeed of my life, was Charlie Gentry. I can't remember a time when I didn't know Charlie. Illness was the first tie that bound us. Our mothers took us to the same pediatrician for treatment of his diabetes and my asthma. Our infirmities relegated us to the role of onlookers in the fiercely masculine little society in which we moved. I think our friendship would have become a fact a lot sooner if Lucy had not come to live with me in my house. For from the very beginning, Charlie did not like her, and it was plain the feeling was mutual. The Gentrys were quite rich when Charlie and I first became friends, but when Charlie was in his first year at Emory Law, Thad Gentry suddenly went ferociously and ebulliently mad and gave all the family Coca-Cola stock to a black television evangelist, and Charlie and his mother were left in severely straitened circumstances. It's a mystery to me how Charlie kept himself so whole, so steeped in the cheerful, pragmatic integrity that was always to me the thing about him that set him so apart from the rest of us. Not many people are genuinely good. It may be that the tremendous effort he had to expend to accommodate his diabetes made him early into invincible stuff. Charlie was, if anything, wry and taciturn, and in repose, his sweet, ugly frog's face unlit by his mordant black self's wit, he seemed downright phlegmatic. And he had learned early on to shield his vulnerability with a kind of affable, shambling passivity that sat perfectly on his short, stocky frame. But I knew, and more than a few other people came to know, that under the dun-colored cloak of the artisan beat a great and passionate heart. I first saw that passion on an afternoon in Charlie's house, poking boredly through old trunks. "Let's go downstairs," I said. "This stuff's making me choke." But Charlie squatted before a trunk, perfectly still, a saber lying across his outstretched hands like a sacrificial offering, and I saw in his transformed brown eyes that he had truly and forever lost his soul. "My great-grandfather's," he said in the kind of voice that should be kept for worship or after love. There is a small army of them across the country, relicers like Charlie, a ridiculous and burning and somehow enormously appealing band of fanatics who spend their lives and often their fortunes walking the battlefields of the Civil War with metal detectors in their hands and shells, both live and dead, in the trunks of their cars. They will and do willingly go to jail for trespassing on national battlefields and digging on government and private land, and they often lose wives and families to their mania. Some have lost limbs and even their lives when a shell fired 130 years ago finally finds its mark. Charlie had just become one of the small army of relicers. Charlie carried that flame with him always, just under his stolid surface, and if I could not truly share it, still I felt proud that of all the boys coming to adolescence in Buckhead then, he chose to let only me know the warmth of his, me and Sarah Cameron. It was many years before Charlie, shy with a homely outsider's self-consciousness, would have anything to do with the diligent coquettes who made up our singular high school crowd, called the Pinks and the Jails. Sarah was, from our earliest memory, included as naturally in our group activities as another small boy. Later, when Charlie and I began to go about in our oblivious twosome, it was only Sarah who was allowed to make a third. I think it was because nothing, not a single tendon, muscle, or atom of small Sarah threatened or puzzled us. She radiated simplicity and a kind of joyous empathy. She was as staunch and great-hearted a companion as any boy could wish, and supremely comfortable to be with, because there was nothing about her oblique or veiled or obscure. Her white grin was quick and open. Her sherry eyes were warm and lit with absolute approval. Her taut, supple brown body was even quicker than ours to master the thousand little athletic rituals and the dance of childhood, and her mind leaped along with and ahead of us like a dolphin in a warm sea. Charlie loved her. I don't know when I became aware of that, when it dawned upon me with the force of revelation, that the light in Charlie's brown eyes on those afternoon forays into the battlefields around the city was not all for the memento mori that we found there. Once I saw, it was as if I'd always known, and that he had always loved her. Sarah would not come to the house on Peachtree Road. She would trot as easily into Charlie's house as I did, and she would accompany us anywhere around Buckhead that was in walking or bicycling range. But she would, when the suggestion was made to go to my house and read my comics or play in the summer house, simply disappear. I was nearly 13 before I asked her why. She was then 11, the same age as Lucy. "Because," she said, looking at me levelly out of her great amber eyes, "I am afraid of Lucy." I knew that she was not afraid of anything in the world, at least that Charlie and I could discover, so for a moment I simply stared at her, taken aback. Presently she flushed. "I can't help it if you think I'm silly. I told you the truth. I really am scared of her."
"Well, that's just dumb," I said finally. "She can't hurt you."
"That's not the kind of scared I mean," Sarah said, and she would say no more. It was an odd time for me, that time swung between the first great Lucy-drunk stretch of my young childhood and high school. I had already had, in Lucy, a strange, chaste love, and I had now a friend. Had two, really, in Charlie and Sarah. I was grateful for the latter, and largely content to live in the mindless, sensation-drowned nowness of the moment, of simply being young. But there was a prowling unease and a waiting under the peaceful stasis, an emptiness. The hole in my heart was shaped like Lucy. I missed her. And yet something in me was disgracefully and cravenly grateful for the hiatus. I am sure that I knew on some level that it could not last. Lucy broke it herself on a summer night later that year when my parents and Aunt Willa gave the largest party I could remember in the Peachtree Roadhouse. It was, and always, a night I will not forget. It was a portentous night and a terrible one. But if it had not happened, I might have lost her forever. The party was, I heard my mother say, to pay back a number of social obligations that she and my father had incurred during the past season. But I knew that it was to market Lucy's 8-year-old sister, Little Lady, and grudgingly, Lucy, to the mother brokers of the Buckhead Boys. Mothers of daughters just coming to flower had one like it every summer. The formal selling of familial flesh would begin much later, with the elaborate machinery of the debut year. This first testing of the waters was much like a match race for year-old fillies. Everyone would be there. Except me. They could not budge me. Try as my mother might, I simply refused to put on my lone, too-short summer suit and pass hors d'oeuvres and trays of drinks to the coiffed and curried and strange-eyed mothers of the boys who were my friends. In the end, my mother gave in. Better an absent son and heir than one made stupid by sullenness. And so I was alone when Lucy came to me in the summer house, lying on my back on the daybed under the lone wall lamp, reading Moby Dick. She stood in the door, against the light from the radiant, reverberating house, without speaking, and when I sensed her presence and raised my head to look at her, I did not know who she was for a moment. In her new yellow princess dress, with a gardenia from the bush beside the lily pond, in her cloudy hair, she was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. Before my eyes fully cleared and some of the old Luciness settled back around her, I saw a woman and could not speak with the weight of it on my chest. I saw also that she held a nearly full bottle of bourbon in one hand and that she was more than a little drunk. I do not know what got into us that night. I had never tasted liquor, and so far as I knew, neither had she. My father would be furious, I knew, if he caught us drinking his stolen bourbon in the summer house, and my mother would come near to dying, volubly so. I could not even imagine what Aunt Willa would do. Before another hour was out, we had drunk it all. It was not late, perhaps 10:30. The party was in full spate. We could hear the steady, deep rhythm of it, chugging along like a well-tuned engine. It would not start to falter for another 2 hours. The night was thick and hot, moonless, almost starless. A deep, sweet sadness lay just beneath everything we said and did, but riding atop that was laughter, the endless, mindless, unstoppable, drowning laughter of first intoxication. I felt that I could laugh forever with the sheer gladness of having her back with me, flopped on her back on the daybed beside me with her pretty shoes, kicked any which way on the floor and her skirts up, showing a ruffle of crinoline and a gleam of smooth white leg. She laughed too, laughed and laughed, laughed the rich, bawdy, affirming laugh that will forever be in my ears, essence of Lucy. And then all of a sudden she was crying. Crying so fiercely and terribly that I thought they would hear her in the house, over the music and their laughter. And I put my clumsy, bourbon, bumbling fingers over her mouth, but she shook them away. Presently she whispered, "Gibby, it was so awful. I missed you so much. I thought I was going to die and they would just let me. They wouldn't care." "But you wouldn't even talk to me, Lucy," I said. "I thought maybe you were mad at me. I thought you didn't want me around you. Why didn't you say something? I would have come. I was waiting for you to come save me. You said you would when you read Mallory to me. You said you always would. Gibby, why didn't you come?" I began and then fell silent. She was right. I had promised. "Oh, Gibby, I was so afraid." It was a great primal howl of pure aloneness, with nothing in it of childhood. My own boyhood fled as if it had never been. I took her in my arms again and stopped her cries with my own blind mouth, and before I finally pulled myself back from the answering mouth and hands and body of my cousin Lucy, I was on top of her, and she was thrashing wildly beneath me on the daybed and moaning words I still to this day blush to remember. And I was so near to entering her that only catastrophe saved me. Instead of making love to Lucy in the summer house in my 12th year and her 10th, I leaned over her and vomited on the floor. From Jack Daniel's Black Label and Terror, and the sheer awfulness of it wrenched me sober. I think it did her, too. She did not say goodnight or wave or turn to look back when she gained the back door. And I spent the first entirely sleepless night of my life on the hot, tangled daybed, writhing in shame and misery and short-circuited adolescent tumescence. So we were back in that old dance, she and I. But under it, now a different music surged. That fall, I entered the 8th grade at North Fulton High School, and the world widened, just as I had thought that it would, to include a great many odd and marvelous things. But so deeply did the scent of danger and taboo cling in my mind to that night in the summer house that it was literally years before I kissed a girl again. I went into North Fulton High School, in a sense, to live, and inside those tall, arched doors, a world wider and deeper than any I had known before flowered. Wider, deeper, denser, more eccentric, far more rakish, many times poorer, 100 times more exotic, 1,000 times more seductive. I first goggled at it in simple disbelief, and then dived into it like a warm and all-nourishing sea. High school came for me, and for many of the Buckhead boys, I think, just in time. Unlike virtually anyone else in my immediate crowd, except Charlie Gentry, I liked to study, especially history and English literature, and I made impressive grades. I could lose myself for hours in the dreaming, sunny flower fields of the school and public libraries, and only after I came blinking and stretching up for air and awareness did I realize how totally happy I'd been. It was the beginning of my lifelong passion for pure research. The only true love, save one, that never left or betrayed me. Lucy graduated from Miss Beauchamp's with just enough credits to secure her freedom, and that fall entered the 8th grade at North Fulton High. In the 3rd week of my sophomore year, I went down onto the burning athletic field to meet the 3 other members of the 880 relay team for the 2nd practice of the season. I was late. I ran silently down the stone steps of the stadium, my cleated shoes in hand, in dread of the coach's coiled tongue. But they were not looking at me. They were standing close together, backs to me, heads close together, obviously staring at something across the field I could not see. They were laughing, and though I could not hear what they said, I knew the tenor of that laughter. I'd heard it 100 times in locker rooms and dark booths when the talk of fucking and genitalia began. It was the laughter of the Buckhead boys for a girl considered to be little better than a whore. I heard the huge coach say something that ended in, "Little pussy right out there on a stick. Bet we could all get a lick of that without even asking for it." I reached the group and looked beyond it to see who they were talking about. And it was Lucy. She was standing with her 6th period soccer class, doing nothing but standing stock still in the sun on the edge of the group of girls, dressed as they all were, in the hated blue bloomers and white shirt. But all of a blinding sudden, I could see what they saw. The white flesh of Lucy Bondurant, looking so totally naked in the merciless sunlight of September that the shorts and shirt might as well not have been there. Small, sharp breasts that appeared absolutely bared even under the starched white. Long legs joined in so obvious a cupping of tender genitalia that the blue bloomers could have been made of transparent netting. Lucy's clothing was not tight, and she did not flaunt her body, did not even move it. She simply stood straight and still, looking back across the field at them. They turned and saw me then, and fell abruptly silent, and the laughter stopped. The afternoon swung around me. The air swarmed like bees. Now everyone knew what I had always known. Lucy Bondurant went naked in the world. Lucy could be taken. I had, once again and now irrevocably, failed to shield and protect her, and in that moment, the power of my sainthood fled for the last time, and only the hunger for it remained. Going into her teens, there was not a girl or woman in Atlanta from 12 to 30 who could touch Lucy Bondurant for sheer impact. At 13, she was as tall and fully developed as she would ever be, her blue eyes unclouded and black-lashed, her waist spannable by 2 masculine hands, her dark wings of hair falling softly against her cheeks in the sleek, loose page boy of the preceding decade. She also adopted smoking 2 or 3 years before the other girls, and she adored liquor from that first stolen swallow of Jack Daniels. From the moment she walked into North Fulton High School, from the moment she lifted her head and stared across a bleached and blinding athletic field into the hungry, betraying eyes of the 880 relay team, it was men for Lucy. Men all the way. Toward the end of March in my senior year at North Fulton, my father asked me to come downtown and meet him for lunch at the Capital City Club. I was as profoundly surprised as if he had asked me to attend a burlesque show with him. I went down on a Friday noon, parking the Fury in the lot beside the club and tossing the keys to ancient liveried James, who had been fielding keys ever since I could remember. I could not imagine why my father wanted to have lunch with me, but I sensed that there was no hope of its being casual or even pleasant. I imagined that he would tell me that we'd all lost our money and I would have to drop out of Princeton, where I had applied and been accepted, and go to work, or that he had cancer and was dying, or that Lucy was being sent away somewhere irrevocable and distant, and I would never see her again, and he was preparing me. To my surprise, Ben Cameron Sr., Ben and Sarah's father, unfolded his lean length from the chair opposite my father and rose to greet me, and my thrashing heart gave a mad buck of relief and subsided. Whatever it was, I had an ally. I reached the table and put out my hand like the confident young man I was not and had never been. "Sorry I'm late," I said, frowning purposefully, like a man who has set aside important affairs to keep a date. "Traffic on Peachtree was awful all the way in." "Get used to it," Ben Cameron said, smiling ruefully. "Not going to get any better in your lifetime. Although it's a fond, if perhaps premature, hope of mine that one day we'll have some kind of fast rail system that'll bring people right through all that mess in downtown in a few minutes. But I'm afraid you'll have to muck it out along with the rest of us until we can part the city from enough money to do it." I looked at him blankly, and then at my father. I had not made any secret of the fact that I had been accepted at Princeton, and then hoped to go to New York to work for a year or two afterward. Ben Cameron knew, too. Why then was he talking as though I would soon be driving down Peachtree Road to the office downtown where my father had recently moved his real estate affairs? I know, Ben said. Princeton, all that, but I got to talking with your daddy at the athletic club last week. It just seemed, all of a sudden, that you're going all the way up there and then on to that overgrown Yankee town's a terrible loss. Both your mama and your daddy and this town of ours. Your dad told me your mind was made up and there was no use trying to change it, but hell, you know me, I'll try anything. So I invited myself to lunch with you and your pa, and I'm going to give you my best shot. I took a large swallow of bourbon. What do you say to rethinking this Princeton business, Shep? Ben said. The university's got a good history department, if that's what you want, or Tech's got a first-rate industrial management, or even a political science department. Don't worry about getting in. We can take care of that. I was silent, and I suppose he mistook my silence for refusal. But in truth, I could not have said anything if I'd wanted to. What was going on here? Why was this conversation happening? If it's real estate you're worried about, I don't think your dad would be too heartbroken if you tried your hand at something else for a little while. It's a rewarding career for a man, Shep, real estate. And done right, a way to give something back to the community, and your dad's holdings are considerable indeed. Managed well, they do a lot for both your family and your town. We need you here, in Atlanta. Not only us, but a whole new generation coming on behind us. Your generation, even the one after you. You have talents you may not even know you have, and you surely will have substantial family assets one day. Both should be kept in your town. Do you read me, Shep? Yes, sir, I said. I do. Well, what do you think about it? I looked at my father again, and this time he was looking at me. And I saw in his face a kind of enormous, guarded flatness that covered something I could not fathom. And then suddenly, I will never know how, I did know it. It was a great, formless, all-pervading indifference to me and to this conversation. And beneath that was a simple dislike that I knew had its genesis not in me, for you do not dislike that which you have put out of your mind, but in Ben Cameron. My father did not want to be here with me and Ben Cameron having this conversation, and he did not want me to stay in Atlanta and manage his real estate holdings one day, and he could barely veil the resentment at the man opposite him who was trying so hard to persuade me. It was a moment of perfect, ringing epiphany. And through the shock of it, I wondered, mildly and mindlessly, at what precise moment my father had given up on me as the son he had so long intended to inherit the kingdom. I don't know where I found the clarity or the courage. I have never been noted in my dealings with my father for either. Thanks, sir, but there's really no use thinking about it, I said briskly. I really do want to go to Princeton and on to New York like I'd planned, and that's what I'm going to do, if my father would still agree to it. My father made a gesture of concurrence and dismissal and raised his finger for the waiter with a check and excused himself. Ben Cameron and I were silent on our way to the parking lot, and then, as we waited for James to bring our cars around, he said, "You're smarter than I gave you credit for, Shep. Princeton's the place for you, and after that, well, we'll see. I had no business putting the arm on you like that. I hope you forgive me for any pain it caused you. Will you shake on it?" He got into his big new Lincoln and shut the door. "You know, I've always thought you were pretty special, Shep," he said. "I'd have been proud to have you as a son. Still would, much as I think of that son of mine. I was wrong to pressure you. But one day when you're back from school and have some time, I want you to come over and talk to me about your family's business. I promise I won't try to sell you on it if by that time you truly believe it's not for you. But there are some things about it you need to know. And I don't think your father is ever going to tell you. Will you do that?" "Sure," I said, tears of love and gratitude pricking behind my eyes. I squinted as if in the sun so he would not see. "But can't you tell me now?" "No, it's not the right time for it. But before too long. Don't let me forget. It's important." "I won't," I said. And he eased the car into gear and flipped me a small wave. I drove back to North Fulton in the fury, filled, if I had not been before, with the absolute, still certainty that whatever there was for me in the world lay far away from Atlanta and all its sucking resonances.
Shep had deliberately not told Lucy of his plans, and the first she heard of his intention was through a casual remark at dinner that evening.
She reacted instantaneously and violently. I'd not seen her behave so at a meal since we were both children. "You can't!" she cried, standing up so suddenly that her chair nearly toppled behind her. "Gibby, you can't! You promised! I won't let you! Uncle Shepard, don't let him! Make him stay here! Make him go to Emory and live at home!" "Lucy!" Aunt Willa's voice cut Lucy's anguished tirade short. She turned and knocked the chair the rest of the way over and ran out of the dining room and up the stairs. No one spoke until the thud of her feet vanished behind the slamming of her door. In the morning she was calm, if red-eyed and pale, and she did not mention my going to Princeton. She left for school early, and I can't remember if we talked of it again at any length before I left, because it was that very afternoon she came home enveloped smugly in the yellow MG and the goatish golden aura of Red Chastain. He was the son of a vastly wealthy fertilizer manufacturer in southeast Georgia, and had been shipped around the South from one military school to another since he was 7 years old, seldom lasting more than a year before being expelled for some flagrant, lazy, and mocking infraction of the rules. Red Chastain looked so much like the faded photographs of a young Jim Bondurant Lucy kept in a scrapbook in her room that I started when I met him, as if he had actually been that gilded ghost. In the last week of May, a scant week before I graduated from North Fulton, we went in a flock of snorting cars on a still hot afternoon out to the Chattahoochee River, where it ran under the tall old abandoned steel bridge beside Robinson's Tropical Gardens. I was with Sarah Cameron. Even Sarah seemed afflicted by the restlessness that rode under the flat surface of the day. Gentry was alone, but he rode with Sarah and me in the back seat of my Fury, cracking smart-ass jokes and glancing at Sarah to see how she would respond to them. Lucy came with Red Chastain. Undischarged sexual tension hummed like electricity prowling a live wire. Most of us had necked and petted ourselves near crazy in the long hot nights after the dances. Exams loomed, and over us all, especially those of us who were 17 and 18 and seniors, there drifted the frightened miasma that overhangs each of the great divisions of life and time. Sarah is adamant in her contention that it was Lucy who began it. She's probably right. I was too far away to hear her, but it was an always Lucy's sort of thing, and on this day she was primed for it like a pulsing pump. "Last one in that river is a Bovis Harden," Sarah says Lucy cried and was out of her skirt and sleeveless blouse and black Capizio shoes before the words were out of her mouth. She stood, poised on the railing with white gripping toes, stripped down to her nylon panties and bra, naked on every silvery white inch of her save a few, giving a strange, long, wordless, jubilant cry and diving like a polished knife out and down into the sky-smitten water fully 20 feet below. Red Chastain, stripped also to his undershorts, followed her in a lazy panther's racing dive. We all stared in absolute silence. Then Snake cupped his mouth in his hands and gave the great hideous Tarzan cry out of all the Saturday matinees of our childhood and went off the bridge. The long tension of the day was broken then. One by one, shouting, the pinks and gels of Buckhead skinned out of their clothes and dived into the water. "It's the worst kind of showing off," Sarah Cameron said to me in a low, urgent voice. "It's gumption and not courage. Be really brave and don't do it." Of them all, only she and one other person knew that my fear of heights went beyond mere terror into mindlessness. Lucy had always known. Everyone was laughing except Lucy. She stood a little apart, dripping and slender as a water reed, head thrown back, body gleaming through the sucking nylon, blue eyes blazing straight into mine, hands cupping her mouth, and called up, "Come on, Gibby Jumper will think you're North Fulton fruitcake. Come on! Mark my trail!" And at that summons out of our childhood, I ripped off my pants and shirt, scrambled desperately up onto the hot steel railing, steadied myself on the struts, and poised blindly for a dive. I opened my eyes then, for one despairing moment, and looked down into the water so sickeningly far below, and saw there instead only the endless wheeling sky. I toppled backward onto the bridge, pulled myself up on my hands and knees, and vomited. From below, Lucy's laughter soared above a scrambled chorus of hard, bright jubilation. It seemed to go on forever. By the time I'd gotten numbly into my clothes and walked back to the Fury, where I'd parked it on the verge of a bridge, stiff and silent with Sarah in my wake, Lucy had come sleek and dripping and incandescent up the bank, shimmering like a young otter. Red Chastain grinned insolently behind her. "What's the matter, Gibby?" she said lightly and merrily. "Ain't something didn't agree with you?" Red laughed. Sarah Cameron drew her slender brown arm back and slapped Lucy so hard that her neck snapped back and her wet hair lashed across her face. "I will never forgive you for that, Lucy Bondurant," Sarah said in a voice I did not know and never heard again. "Shep will, because he's a fool, but I won't." We walked on past them, and were in the airless front seat of the Fury before we heard any of them speak, and I could not tell what it was they said. I turned the key and eased the car onto the sunlit emptiness of Pace's Ferry Road. Neither of us looked back. We drove home without a word, but when I let her out at the bottom of the long Cameron driveway, I leaned over and kissed Sarah briefly on her soft mouth, which tasted surprisingly of tears. "Thank you, Sarah," I said. "You're welcome, Shep," she replied. From that day until the summer morning I left for Princeton, I went few places without Sarah at my side. Lucy's tears of remorse that evening were fierce and real enough, and she was so wildly and desperately penitent that I forgave her as I always had and would. As Sarah had said I would. But the slight remove between us now was impenetrable. I wanted then two things only. I wanted to be near the ease and lightness and safety that was Sarah, and I wanted to get away from Atlanta and into Princeton. Sarah came regularly to Princeton for football games and later colonial dances, and my mother and father came, rarely, for formal constrained parental visits. But except for brief and obligatory trips south for Christmas and Easter, and a few unavoidable vacations, I did not come home again for a long time, and then, through no choice of my own. By that time, Lucy had gone.
Shep loved Princeton. When Sarah Cameron did visit him, they spent chaste, idyllic weekends together there. In Atlanta, Charlie Gentry happily escorted Sarah to parties and dances, even though he understood that he was a stand-in for his old friend. Sarah and Shep's weekends together continued after he graduated and moved into an apartment in the Chelsea section of New York. They went to museums, galleries, and jazz clubs together, finishing the long days in Shep's apartment, but Sarah always slept in her room at the Barbizon Hotel for Women. Shep found a job in the rare manuscripts department of the New York Public Library and supplemented his small salary with income from his grandfather's trust.
It had been almost a year since I had even heard about Lucy, and that information had come not from her, but from, of all people, her mother, my Aunt Willa. She had called me one raw Friday evening and said that she was in New York and would love to have lunch and a nice catch-up chat the next day. We made a date for noon the next day. I saw Aunt Willa immediately. She had snared a corner table by the window. I sat down warily, with a sense of walking clear-eyed and of my own volition, into a trap. "I'm deeply worried about my daughter, Shep," Aunt Willa said. "She's headed for heartache, and I wanted to ask your advice. You always did seem to be able to get through to her when no one else could, and what daughter listens to her mama nowadays?" "What's the matter?" "Lucy is about to get herself kicked out of Agnes Scott College, and if she does, she can forget all about marrying Red Chastain, because his father will cut him off without a cent when it comes out why she did."
"Well, what's she up to?" I said.
"Well, among other things, among many other things," Aunt Willa said, "she has written an editorial in the campus newspaper," she edits, "about that horrible Martin Luther King and how he's a new American saint, and several newspapers around the South have printed it. The Constitution had a headline that said, 'Deb defends sit-ins,' an Atlanta princess takes up the flag of freedom. Can you imagine the idea all over the South? I tell you, I have heard nothing since the story ran but that. Everybody's laughing about it." "Well, I thought, of course, Lucy and the Negroes again. Ever since she was a child and joined the companionship of the servants at 2500 Peachtree Road, she'd been drawn to the company of Negroes. It was the only thing left that raised Willa's ire, and the only one likely in these days to inflame Buckhead enough to seriously threaten her clawed-out niche in its society." "Now, surely they can't be serious about expelling her from Scott for that," I said. "My God, she's been editor of that paper for both years she's been there. I thought her journalism and English grades were right at the top." "Oh, yes, they are, but they're the only ones that are. She's so close to flunking everything else she's taken that I've had letters from every one of her teachers. And then, of course, she's broken every rule in the book. Lucy never studies. Spends all her time with that Negro boy Ben Cameron's raising over there, that Glenn Pickens person.
Now Ben's sending him to college, no less, down at the Negro school on the south side. Moore, something. Morehouse, I said automatically. And half the time, Lucy's down there with him in meetings about civil rights and sit-ins and all that vulgar stuff. What about Red? Is he mad at her, too? Oh, no, I don't think so, Aunt Willis said. I gave in and let her start going up to visit him at Princeton, hoping it would keep her too busy to run around with niggers. But it doesn't matter whether he is or not, because if Farrell Chastain lays down the law to him, you can bet he'll drop Miss Lucy faster than a rattlesnake. Well, has she stopped? She hasn't been out with that colored boy for the past week, but then he's over in Mississippi stirring up the niggers over there about registering to vote. Shep, I want you to talk to her. Surely you can see she's about to ruin her life, much less all our good names. Will you call her and talk to her? She'll listen to you. She always would. Aunt Willa, I can't. To my horror, she put her face down in her hands and began to cry. She's going to ruin everything for me, she sobbed. She's not going to stop until she's done it. Oh, I just wish she just died when she was born. Anger flooded me. All right, I'll call her, but I don't want to hear you say that about her ever again. Thank you, Shep, she said meekly. She's over at Princeton this weekend, but she'll be back tomorrow night. Could you call her then? I agreed to do it, not at all sure that I would. I might not have called Lucy after all, but I met an old friend who told me that he had been over to Princeton that day and had seen Lucy with Red Chastain on the veranda of Tiger, and that both had been falling down drunk at high noon and all over each other. I hardly slept at all that night. I knew then that I would call her and would probably regret doing it, but that couldn't be helped. The old ties had held after all. The old bone still ran deep. It was not a good call. I stumbled and hemmed and hawed and stopped and started, and through it all she was silent, not helping me at all. Finally, I blurted out that I'd seen her mother in New York and that everyone was very worried about her, and I wanted to talk to her about it. About what? Lucy said pleasantly. About... Oh, shit, Lucy, about school and the poor stupid Negroes, mostly about that bunch of corrupt fools Red runs around with a tiger, I said in a rush. You've got no business messing around with that gang. You're going to get yourself talked about all over the East Coast. There was another pause, and then her creamy, whiny belly laugh curled out at me over the wire. What else is new? She said, and then she stopped laughing. You've turned into a real prick, Gibby, she said coolly, and the words stung me more sharply than I thought was possible. You've got no business telling me who I can and cannot hang around with, she slammed on the telephone. So I was as shocked as if I had seen a literal apparition when, at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning the following November, I floundered out of sleep to answer a pounding on my door and opened it to find Lucy, distinctly drunk and looking lost and lovely in a man's filthy London fog, leaning against the door sill, smoking and smiling at me. Hey, Gibby, she said. Can I come in? Yeah, sure. Come on in. Aren't you going to ask me what I'm doing here? She asked gaily, and I thought then that there was something more than alcohol burning inside her. What are you doing here? I said. I was suddenly and uncomfortably aware that I wore only the pair of chinos I had pulled on hastily when the knocking had begun. Oh, I was in the neighborhood and thought I'd drop in. I assume you're up for a weekend with Red and the gang at Old Nassau, I said. Right you are, she said. The hectic laughter bubbled just under her voice and burned in her cheeks. It's a Yale game. Red never misses it. Only he did this year. He's been passed out in his room since 11 o'clock this morning. Well, who gives a shit? There were 74 others to party with. Lucy, I said, stung with annoyance and distaste and something else I could not name. You're heading for more trouble than you knew there was in the world. You don't have to worry about me, Gibby, she said. When couldn't I handle Red? Sit down and take your coat off, I said. You make me nervous pacing around like that. She turned to me, smiling a strange, closed-mouthed smile, and then suddenly threw the coat off and dropped it on the floor, and stood there wearing only a white nylon slip. She was naked underneath it. I dropped my eyes. I was not going to let a drunk, contentious Lucy throw me. I decided to ignore her nakedness. Well, how do you like my place?
To tell you the truth, I hadn't thought about it, she said. But I do like it. It's like a little train. She began to laugh. I was about to join in, seduced into mirth against my will, when I saw the marks on her throat. They were ugly and unmistakable. The vermilion prints of 10 fingers at the base, where the slender white column joined the elegant ridged collarbone. An older purple bruise spread up the side of her neck into her hairline. Who choked you, Lucy? I said. Was it Red? Did it happen this weekend? Is that why you came? She stopped laughing abruptly. He didn't choke me, she said. Her face closed. He just kind of shook me a little. He didn't know he was being so rough. He was awfully sorry. No, it's not at all why I came. I told you, I just... Lucy, this is me. Cut the shit. What was he, drunk or just mean as hell? She didn't answer. I saw that her eyes had found my lone bottle of bourbon. After a long moment of silence, she said, he doesn't mean anything by it, you know. Red doesn't. I was being sort of loud and silly, and he couldn't get me to stop. That was all. It's just his way of showing me that he loves me. I just looked at her. Daddy used to do it, she went on, her voice getting louder. It's not uncommon. Daddy did it because he loved me, too. I'd be bad and he'd kind of hit me. And then he'd cry because he'd had to. Poor Luce, I said. Some night I made you. I haven't managed to save you from a single dragon so far, have I? She looked at me intently. You could save me from one now. Red? No, she said. Suddenly she was crying silently. No, not Red. I put my hands on her shoulders. She did not lift her head. What then? Oh, Kitty, I'm so afraid, she whispered. Tell me what you're afraid of, Lucy, I said. Of everything in the world, she sobbed. Of everything I can't control. I tried to laugh hearteningly and did not succeed. Then you'll be afraid most of your life, baby, I said. She turned her face up to me and it was fierce. Then I won't live. Because I can't stand that. To be afraid for the next 60 or 70 years, I can't stand it for one more. I'd rather die. Lucy, nobody can control their lives. Not really, I said. But it doesn't mean you have to be afraid all the time. You just sort of forget about it. Go on, live your life. Well, other people are stronger than I am then, she said. Or they have something I don't, because I can't stand not being safe. Not knowing what's going to happen to me next. It's like waiting to fall off the world. I feel that way all the time, Gibby. All the time. Her voice rose. I have to know I'm safe. I have to know somebody's taking care of me. Lucy. The crying became wilder. Promise, she sobbed. Promise me. Promise me you'll take care of me. I promise, I said automatically, stroking her back and her hair. You mean it? Sure I do, I said. Then marry me. I was silent, the shock stopping my breath for a moment. Lucy, the surest way I know to wreck both our lives is to marry you. Understand, right now, that isn't going to happen. Not now, not ever. It wouldn't be right. It would ruin us both. Cousins don't. Cousins can't. Her movement was almost that of some great snake. She turned in my arms as swiftly and with such a smooth slide of muscle that before I could even flex my own, she was all over me and against me, wrapping her legs around my waist, squirming herself beneath me, wriggling out of the slip. She did not speak. Her hands were at my fly and then inside, and then I felt her warm nakedness against mine. And a great, deep, primal thrust and surge, a monstrous great stiffening, and knew that I was about one beat away from losing this fury inside her. My erection felt as massive and volatile and inexorable as a volcano. She found it frantically and was guiding it into herself at the same moment that I tore myself free of her and rolled off the bed. Under the pounding desire was a white anger, and under that, even more powerful, a blind fear. I turned to the wall and zipped up my pants. Get up and put on your coat, I said levelly. I'm going to take you back to Princeton. I heard her laugh and turned. She was lying naked on her back, hands under her head, legs asprawl.
I turned my head away.
You did want it, didn't you, Gibby? She said. I know you did. I can feel it. I can see it now down there in your pants. Lordy, it must be something fantastic by now, because I know you've been saving it up all for Sarah, and we both know she wouldn't know a hump from a hula hoop, don't we?
I picked up the raincoat and jerked her up off the bed and pulled it around her. She stared at me, smiling and wild-eyed. And then the subterranean something that had burned deep within her all evening, like a fire in the earth under a peat bog, died abruptly out, and her face was empty and tired and slack.
I'm sorry, Gibby, she said. I get really sloppy when I drink too much. You know, Red was right to belt me. Look, I don't want you to take me back. Just call me a cab and lend me some money, will you? I can be back in Princeton before my hero even misses me.
Reassured, if only slightly, I walked her out into the silent street where I flagged a late cruising cab. Penn Station, I said to the driver. I put my head inside the window and kissed Lucy's cheek. She looked utterly beautiful. And at her answering, wide, world-healing smile, I wondered, briefly and wildly, what it might be like after all, being married to Lucy Bondurant and custodian of that slender, lovely body and all its urgent hungers. Be good, I said. She reached up and touched my mouth very lightly with the tops of her fingers. That's just what I'm going to do, Gibby, she said. That night, just past 9, when the night raids came into effect, my mother called me and told me that Lucy and Red Chastain had left Princeton early that morning and driven straight through to Elkton, Maryland, and had been married there by a justice of the peace. It was 1959, the end of my first year in New York. A great stillness settled over me then, which might have been emptiness, or might have been peace. In June of 1960, the calls from Lucy began. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. Hello, I said warily.
Hey, Gibby, she said. It's Lucy, honey.
From then on until her death, almost every telephone conversation we had began with that deep drag from the cigarette and her throaty little,
Hey, Gibby.
Lucy, what's the matter?
Nothing's the matter.
Lucy, it's 5 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, you're 3 hours ahead? Oh, I never will get used to that. It's just two here. I've been to a party, she said. And everybody else has pooped out, and I'm not that sleepy yet. Just bored. All of a sudden, I thought I'd like to hear your voice. It's been a long time, Gibby.
Only 8 months, 2 weeks, and 4 days, I said. Word of her and Red had come fairly frequently from my mother. After his father cut off his money, Red had announced that he'd always wanted to be a Marine and enlisted within the hour. And they left at noon for Parris Island, South Carolina, in the white Jaguar that had been Farrell's high school graduation present to his son. Between them, Lucy and Red had $55.14. There had followed for Red boot camp, officer candidate school at Quantico, Virginia, an invitation to the elite and dangerous Army Ranger School at Fort Benning, and finally a tour of duty as a second lieutenant at Camp Pendleton, California. Red found that he was as good at being a golden killing machine as he had been at being a rich boy, and he liked it a great deal more. It gave him a focus and a license that all the civilian years of his life had not. By the time he was 24 years old, he was as totally assimilated into his new persona and world as if he had been born to it. And Lucy hung there with him. Why don't you wake up Red and party with him, I said.
Red's been out for 2 weeks, slithering through the swamps with a knife between his teeth, garroting rattlesnakes and blowing up yuccas, she said, giggling. He's in training to overthrow Cleveland.
Then who are you partying with?
His CO, she chortled. Captain Rafer Hodges, 7 feet tall and tow-headed as a yard dog and with a tattoo that says Semper Fi. I'm not going to tell you where it is. Only his platoon and his wife and I know that.
And where was his wife?
Oh, at home, polishing his saber, I guess, or sleeping the sleep of the just. Where she said she was going when she stormed out of the officers' club after old Rafer danced with me the fourth time straight.
Tell me something, I said.
Why are you drinking so much?
Because it makes everything special.
Luz, you haven't even been married a year. You shouldn't have to drink for things to be special. Even if you hate the life out there, there's Red. You don't hate Red. My God, you went with him for 5 years before you married. You must love him.
Red's changed, she said. About the middle of August, the tales of Red Chastain's drunken and abusive behavior toward her began, and she would sometimes sob plaintively over the telephone, drunk herself more often than not, and began to beg me to come out to Pendleton and rescue her. After each of the first of these calls, I'd called her back the next morning when she was clear-headed and sober, and each time she laughed and told me not to pay any attention to her. So I did not, after a while, worry quite so frantically about her. Sarah visited me several times that summer, and each time she was witness to one of Lucy's late-night calls. She would fall silent when they came, and her lashes would slip down over her great amber eyes, and her mobile mouth would tighten, but she never said anything about them. The week before she was to leave for Paris to study art, Sarah spent a final weekend with me. Still blamelessly based at the Barbizon, she nevertheless spent all but a scant 6 hours of sleeping time with me that Friday night and Saturday. And at 10 o'clock on Saturday night, after a day of soaking up enough galleries and museums and walking and looking and munching and hand-holding and furtive kissing to last us the 9 months until she came home again, we were just sitting down to a takeout pizza and a bottle of Chianti when the telephone rang. "I'll cut this short," I said, reaching for the telephone. Sarah nodded. But I did not cut it short. Lucy was calling from the apartment of one of the other marine wives at Pendleton, and between her incoherent sobs and the other girl's indignant breaking in, it took me nearly an hour to get from Lucy that Red had blackened her eyes and cut her lip and locked her out of their apartment and had threatened to split her skull if she came back in.
"Gibby, what should I do? He's awfully drunk. He could kill me," she wept.
At last I soothed her and extracted a promise from the other wife that she would call me in the morning and tell me how things stood then. I knew that my concern for Lucy was audible. I put the phone down and turned to Sarah, who had not stirred from her chair. Her face was very white, and the high color in her cheeks burned even brighter, but her expression was mild and questioning. "She's in awful trouble," I said. "He's beating her regularly. He's hurt her pretty badly this time. She wants me to come. And I really ought to go." And Sarah exploded.
"If you go out there, Shep," she said between clenched teeth, "you'll have her for the rest of your life. It's what she wants. She always has. You're a fool if you can't see that. And maybe it's what you want, too, no matter what you think or say. But it's not what I want, and I won't have it. I'm not going to share you anymore with Lucy Bondurant. I'm not."
The sight of her pain burst inside me like a rocket, purging me of Lucy and her 3,000-mile tendrils of woe, and I moved over and took Sarah into my arms. But her great, racking, silent sobs continued. I laid her back on the sofa and put my long body over hers, trying with every pound and inch of me to stop the terrible trembling and the cries, to scourge the anguish out of her.
"Don't, Sarah. Please don't. Oh, Shep, do it now,"
she cried out, and I did. Without thought, without qualm, without regret, without consideration for the pain she must feel, or the fear, I shucked her out of her clothes and went into her and plunged there back and forth and felt her settle around me and find my rhythm and ride with it, and felt her hips rise and fall and quicken, and her legs clench my back, and heard her great, hoarse cry as we came together and my own cry escaped me, a cry of gratitude and simple relief and a joy as old and deep as the world. Three weeks after Sarah sailed for France, Red Chastain went on his first long tour of sea duty, and Lucy was alone at Camp Pendleton for nearly 8 months. She called me the night he left, the familiar liquor slur in her voice, the tears just under it.
"Gibby, can you come out here and see me? I'm going to die of loneliness by myself all that time."
It was 3:30 in the morning, and it suddenly struck me with the clarity of revelation
But there was no earthly reason why Lucy had to call me at that hour to tell me she was lonely for Red Chastain.
Lucy, no. I can't come out there to see you. I can't and I won't. You've got 8 months to be safe from Red if that's what you want. I don't want you to call me again unless it's a certifiable life-threatening emergency, and then it better be in the daylight, my time. If you're lonesome, make some friends. Take a course, plant a garden, plant a tree, write a book, but don't tell me about it.
What would I write about, Gibby? Anything, Luce, I said. Anything at all that comes into your head. I'm sure you'll think of something. And I hung up the phone and turned out the light. Sarah was due in at mid-morning on the 5th of June, 1961. Ben and Dorothy Cameron, Sarah's parents, came up from Atlanta to meet her, and I went to the plaza the night before she landed to meet them for dinner in the Oak Room. Ben and Dorothy always stayed at the plaza. I looked at Ben closely that night, as if for the first time seeing the man the entire country would know within a few years as the aristocratic mayor of the southern city that somehow managed to keep, in the firestorms of the mid-1960s, a kind of furious peace with its black citizens. They arranged to pick me up the next morning on the way over to the West Side docks. It was nearly midnight when I got back to my apartment. The phone was ringing. I was fully expecting to hear Ben's voice or Dorothy's, but the voice that came on the line in the little hollow of air that meant long distance was that of a crisp, businesslike young doctor in the base hospital at Camp Pendleton, and for a moment I could not take in what he was saying. Lucy was in the hospital, 5 of her teeth knocked out and her broken jaw wired shut, with an additional broken collarbone and fractured forearm. And there was, in her scalp, a shallow, trench-like laceration where the bullet from Red Chastain's service revolver had grazed her. They could not, the doctor said, be responsible for her condition if I did not come. I sat on the edge of my bed for a long time. Then I called the plaza. I have never known Ben Cameron to be so coldly angry before or since. He said, "I see," a couple of times while I talked, in a voice that was as flat and arctic as a tundra, and when I was done, he said, "Shep, you are a complete and miserable goddamn fool if you go out to California after that poor little piece, and if you do, I can't imagine how long it's going to take before I can talk to you reasonably again." And he handed the phone to Dorothy. "Of course you have to go, Shep," she said. "You can't live your life, nor Sarah with you, under the shadow of a refusal to do so. I only ask that you be very careful with her. She is a danger to herself and a worse one to you. I'll explain to Sarah. She'll understand." But Sarah did not understand. By the time I came home from California, almost a week later, with a pale, shrunken, nearly unrecognizable Lucy, and installed her in her old room in the house on Peachtree Road, and rushed to the downstairs telephone niche to call Sarah, it was to hear from a muted and old-voiced Dorothy Cameron that Sarah had, just 2 nights before, announced her engagement to Charlie Gentry. The announcement had been sent to both newspapers and would appear in the combined edition on Sunday. That was, of course, tomorrow. She hoped that I would come by and speak to Sarah and Charlie. Both were anxious to talk with me. "I hope you will, Shep," she said. "This has been a very, very hard thing for Sarah. It will be a kindness to her if you'll come." But I left Atlanta later that day and went back to New York without seeing her.
If remaining in Atlanta had once seemed unlikely to Shep, it was now clearly impossible. From the moment he took an apartment in New York, Shep's family and friends had tried to persuade him to return to Atlanta. They claimed that the city needed him and his talents. Ben Cameron urgently wanted him to become more aware of the real estate holdings that were the source of his family's wealth. Even Sarah had made no secret of the fact that she planned to remain there. She felt she owed something to the town that had been so good to her and her family. Charlie, who had turned his legal skills to the administration of a philanthropic trust, shared her love for their hometown and her commitment to public service. Shep isolated himself from his friends and family and Lucy, especially Lucy, who had this time done him such irrevocable damage.
In early August, Dorothy Cameron called.
I'm sorry I haven't called until now, she said. I haven't been able to pick up the phone to call you without crying. It's ridiculous. Neither of us has died. Ben's really quite annoyed with me, but it's time to stop this foolishness. Hiding away up there and not answering letters or the telephone is not necessary and really not very smart. I'm calling to ask you to reconsider coming home. Just for a visit, of course. Dorothy, I said, I can't do that. Did Sarah ask you to call? Sarah? No, Dorothy said. Lucy did. She says you won't answer her calls and letters, and she needs very badly to see you and talk to you. I believe she does, Shep. Okay, I said. What kind of trouble has Lucy gotten herself into now? And I warn you, Dorothy, I don't much want to hear it, whatever it is. Lucy's wrecked things for me the last time she's going to. As a matter of fact, she hasn't made any kind of mess that I can see, Dorothy said. Rather the opposite, in fact. She has a job that she seems to love, and she's paying what she can toward a room and board to your parents, and I've never seen her quite like this. She seems happy. Just happy. Not excited or keyed up or manic. There's a sort of inner glow to her and a quietness that I never saw before and that I frankly find most appealing. She says she really needs to try and make things right for you, that she can't get on with her life until she does. Shep, I'm convinced that that's just what she means to do, get on with her life on her own. I'm not going to come home, Dorothy. I just can't do that yet, but I'll talk to her if she still wants me to. Tell her to call me. I'll take it this time. And, Dorothy, how's Sarah? How's she really? Is she, you know, happy? Happy? No, I don't think Sarah's particularly happy right now, Shep, but she's very much all right. She'll be very useful in her marriage and here in Atlanta, and I believe that in time that will make her happy. For girls like Sarah, being useful is far more important in the long run than being merely happy. Damn your high-minded crap, Dorothy, I said. Shep, don't, she said. We love you. We feel your pain. All of us do. Don't lash out at us like this. That night, I wrote to Sarah and Charlie, a letter apiece, short but as warm and penitent as I could make them, benedictory. 2 days later, a telegram came from them, signed, All Our Love, Sarah and Charlie. Please, please, it said, come home for the wedding. But I could not do that. Charlie and Sarah were married on the Saturday after Labor Day. Lucy called that night. Hey, Givvy, she said. And all of a sudden, joy and sadness and pain and glee and simple one-celled nostalgia swept me. What's happening? I said. I've just come back from the wedding. Yeah, I said. And how was the wedding? Well, it was very sweet. Very small and simple and over in almost no time and not really so awful at all. Sarah hugged me before they left and told me to call you up and tell you about it before some old battle axe did, and that they missed you and hoped you'd come see them when they got back from their honeymoon, and that was that. There was something different. It was there in her voice, like a quality of light. I kept listening for the bright sharpness, the wild honey irony, but they were not there. Givvy, Lucy said, please come home. They'll be gone for a couple of weeks at least. You won't run into them, and I need to see you. I need to try and make some of this up to you. I think I can, if you'll let me. But I can't stand being alienated from you like this. Why don't you come see me instead? Givvy, I want you to come home because I've written a book, and Scribner's is publishing it, and it comes out next week. And there are some parties and things here for me, and I want you to come and take me to them. I don't want to go by myself, Givvy. Lucy, I shouted over the phone. That's... God damn, that's wonderful. Why didn't you say something? When did you do that? I wrote it way last summer and fall after Red went on that 8-month tour. Remember? I called you up and whined for you to come out and keep me company, and you said, no, write a book or plant a tree or something. Well, I did. I wrote a book. Oh, one of these parties. Next weekend. Next Saturday and Sunday. I'll be in Friday night. Can you meet me at the airport? I sat up all night, noodling around on my clarinet and playing and replaying my Brubeck records. I did not want, on that evening, to think. Toward daylight, I slid finally and irrevocably toward sleep, and I finally let the desolation of it take me down.
Tonight was the wedding night of Sarah Cameron Gentry, but it was not mine. The next Friday night I slept for the first time in my life in the big back bedroom that was the guest room of the house on Peachtree Road. Lucy slept in the summer house, which had so long been mine. Lucy and I sat late in the summer house after the sorry little ritual of homecoming between me and my parents had been played out. My mother, looking glossier and more sinuous and whiter of skin than ever, had clung to me and fussed and patted and churred. My father, somehow redder and more furious of face, even as he bared his yellowing teeth in what passed between us for greeting, had a couple of quick bourbons and nodded and grinned fairly. Soon after, he took the bourbon decanter and went into the library, saying that he had a good bit of paperwork to get cleaned up. Lucy and I escaped to the summer house as soon as we decently could. "I hope you don't mind," she said, snapping on a single lamp beside the deep, sagging old blue sofa and sinking into its cushions. "I moved out here a week or two after I got home, in June. Nobody seemed to know what to say to me, and I could tell that the cast and the bruises bothered everybody. It just seemed easier all the way around." "I don't mind," I said. "I like to see you out here with your typewriter and your brand new life. You look wonderful." There wasn't any physical difference. The difference was born inside her, and it shone out of her blue eyes and in the soft curve of her mouth like mist from morning water. We stopped at Rusty's on the way to the Peachtree Roadhouse. "To shore you up before the onslaught." She finished her Coke and made a rude childhood noise against the bottom of the glass with the straw. I was drinking beer and had asked if she wanted one too, but she'd shaken her head. "No more booze," she said. "I'm strictly a Coca-holic now." "Listen, Gibby, I want to say this before you shush me. I'll be sorry until the day I die for what I did to you and Sarah. I can't undo that, but I can keep from making anybody else unhappy ever again with my selfishness and my neuroses, and I'm going to. My heart will hurt me every time I see Sarah Gentry or you again as long as I live, and if it helps at all, I want you to know that I've changed. I really have. That may be small comfort, but it's all I can give you. That and just to love you always and wish you everything that's good in the world for the rest of your life." It was an extraordinary speech by any standards, and for Lucy it was astounding. "I like the old model pretty well. I hope she's not in mothballs for good," I said. "There's another reason I'm out here too," she said. "And that is?" I said. "Mother and your folks don't want me in the house. In fact, they want me to move all the way out of it and get a place of my own. They've given me a month to look around, and I thought it would be better to lie low while I did, so I wouldn't keep everybody upset. They're really pretty angry with me. I can't say that I blame them." "Here we go," I thought. Aloud, I said, "Let's have it, Luz." "It's my job. They really hate what I'm doing, and they think I took it to spite them." "For God's sake," I said, "what are you doing?" "I'm working with the civil rights movement," she said, her face literally aflame with the kind of joy. "I'm working downtown at a place called Damascus House. It's an inner-city mission, really, run by Father Claiborne Cantrell. I know you've heard of him or read about him. He's been in Time and Newsweek both. I met Father Cantrell at a rally in early July and was just spellbound by him like everybody is, and literally begged him with tears running down my face to let me come and work for him, and he finally did. Oh, God, I just never knew until now, but this is my real niche, the thing I was meant to do with my life." I had to smile, even as the import of her incandescence and the new uncritical affection for the human race dawned. Lucy and the Negroes again. No wonder her mother and my parents were furious. An amusing little feature about the defiant Deb taking up the cause of equality in the Atlanta Constitution was one thing. Time and Newsweek were quite another. When would they learn that trying to separate Lucy from her beloved Negroes was as futile as parting the moon from its tides? But the implications of her passion were, to me, ominous. "Lucy, what you're meant to do with your life is right," I said. I said it as neutrally as possible, so as not to echo the other furious voices in this house. "What is it you do at this Damascus house?" "I'm registering voters," she said. "I'm matching government resources to individual needs and working the soup kitchen, driving the bus, getting bail bond money for the sit-ins, and Gibby, there's so much to do." Her blue eyes spilled out a light, very near that of madness,
and I was almost afraid of the otherworldliness about her. I take it you're not going to quit then, I said. Well, of course not. Well, then have you got an apartment or something? I've got better than an apartment, Givey, she said. I've got, or I'm going to have, a husband. This time I could only stare at her.
Be happy for me, Gibby, she whispered. I love him. I respect him. He's brave and committed and strong, and he adores the ground I walk on. He's older. He's 38, and he's an accountant who's been with Damascus House since Clay started it, and he's solid and quiet and wry and cynical, and he has a wonderful smile and the strength of the earth, of the world. An accountant? Oh, Lord, Lucy, does he have a name?
She laughed.
Jack. Jack Venable. John Creighton Venable of the Chattanooga Venables. He's an accountant mainly because his family has money. It's even older money than your folks, and his folks won't speak to him either. We have an awful lot in common. He moved here about 2 years ago. He's had a terrible time in his life, Gibby, and he needs me as much as I do him. His wife ran off with another woman and left him with two little boys, Toby and Thomas. They're 9 and 11 now. When I met Jack Venable later that night, I saw immediately that this plain, pale man with his stark white hair and his air of deep stillness that verged on stolidity, and his patience and obvious quiet enchantment with the burning, leaping flame that was Lucy, was indeed just what she had said he was, a wonderful father. For her, the perception was unavoidable. She told me that evening in the summer house that Jack Venable and his motherless children lived in a century-old farmhouse outside the little town of Lithonia, 20 miles to the east of the city. The boys attended public school while Jack commuted to his job and were cared for after school by an old black woman who also cooked and cleaned and did the family laundry. Lucy was enchanted with the prospect of living in the country on a real farm. Well, Lucy, sweetie, I said, it all sounds as nearly perfect as this earth gets. When is the wedding? Can I come be best man? Her face flamed, and she dropped her eyes.
Well, you see, Gibby, she said, it's going to be right soon, maybe like in a couple of weeks, and Glenn Pickens, you know, the Cameron's driver, Glenn, wants to be our best man, and of course Clay will perform the ceremony. It's going to be at Damascus House, really a tiny affair, and only the Negroes who live there, the residents, are going to be guests. Nobody here even knows it yet. I thought with the way my mother and your folks felt about everything and the way some of the Negroes feel about rich white people. I'm as poor as Job's turkey, you know that, I said, stung. Even her discomfort did not compensate for the obvious fact that I would not be welcome at my cousin Lucy's wedding. Come on, this is me, Luce. I know, Gibby, and if it were just me and Jack, I wouldn't think of having a wedding without you. But your daddy, your family, owns an awful lot of land down around Damascus House, and people down there know it. Some of the folks there are tenants of y'all's. White absentee landlords are not exactly popular down there.
I don't own any of it, I said stubbornly. It's my father's, not mine, and nobody knows who I am anyway.
Yes, she said in a subdued voice, they do. Ben Cameron was not at the cocktail party he and Dorothy gave at the driving club. Dorothy, whose welcoming kiss to me was as warm and natural as if great gulfs of pain did not lie between us, whispered in my ear in the receiving line, please don't think Ben's avoiding you. He's down at a rally, but he's going to try to get back before the party's over. Lester Maddox is giving us a hard time, and the election is only 2 months away. Ben must have the Negro vote to win, or he'd be here. It was only then that I remembered that Ben Cameron was running for mayor. Is he still mad at me, Dorothy? I said. Yes, she said, but not in the way he was. He'll get over it, Shep, and he's never stopped loving you. He should have, I said. He ought to just wash his hands of me. He'll never do that, and neither will I, she said, and kissed me on the cheek. After the tea my mother and my Aunt Willa gave for Lucy at the Peachtree Roadhouse the next afternoon, I left Atlanta to go back to New York. The thought was in my mind that I probably would not come back to the house on Peachtree Road or to the city for a very long time, if ever. There was no reason now to do so. Two of the three women who had claimed my heart were gone from me, and most of my other ties to the city were light and ephemeral.
By the time I unlocked my door on West 21st Street, the Sunday night traffic was thinning, and only a stream of lights over on 9th spoke of any life or the forward momentum of time. The air in my apartment was as old and arid as the breath of tombs. Sometime in the small hours of the morning, I came awake with the heavy, marrow-deep certainty that my time in New York was over. That afternoon, I wrote my friend Corey Appleby, who was teaching French at Haddonfield Academy in Vermont, asking if there were any faculty positions open, and when his affirmative reply came by return mail, I drove up the following weekend. Within another 2 weeks, I'd been accepted as an instructor in medieval history, with additional classes in freshman English to start when the new term did, on January 5th, 1962. 4 days before Christmas, my telephone rang at 6:30 p.m. When I picked it up, it was to hear the voice of Lucy Bondurant Venable, which I had not thought to hear then or perhaps at any other time, thick with her familiar long-distance tears, telling me that my father had had a massive stroke that afternoon and was completely paralyzed and not expected to live the night. And so, I left New York at dawn the next day in a rented U-Haul and drove, instead of to Vermont, back to Atlanta and the house on Peachtree Road. I planned to bury my father, comfort my mother, stash my meager belongings, and fly to Vermont as soon as I decently could. If anyone had told me, when I saw the Atlanta city limits sign rise up out of a fast-failing December twilight on the highway in from Gainesville, that I would never leave it again, I would have laughed in his face.
Shep's father did not die. He was returned to the house on Peachtree Road, where he would live for many years in an upstairs room, a helpless invalid, incapable of speech or movement. The family lawyers assumed Shep would be taking over management of his family's real estate interests, but Shep made it plain to them that he had no intention of doing so. Ben Cameron did not intend to let him off easily.
I was in the library, deep in Bullfinch, when Shem Cater put his head into the door and said, "Company to see you, Mr. Shep," and Ben Cameron walked into the room behind him. "Morning, Ben," I said, getting up from the Morris chair I'd been slumped in. "Sit down. Can I offer you some coffee?" "No," he said. "I've got a thermos in the car." "Get your coat and a muffler and gloves, Shep, and come with me, if you got a little time to spare. I want to show you something." "What is it?" I asked. "I'd rather show you," he said. "Indulge me, if you will. I'll have you back in a couple of hours." I was profoundly surprised to see Glenn Pickens sitting at the wheel in a neat dark suit and tie, gray driving gloves on his hands. The Lincoln's powerful motor was idling, and Glenn eased it into motion as soon as I closed the door on my side behind me. He, too, was unsmiling and said nothing beyond his neutral, "Good morning, Shep," in response to my greeting. "Am I being kidnapped?" I asked, accepting a cup of coffee from Ben's thermos and grinning as he added a dollop of brandy from a silver flask in his pocket.
"As a matter of fact, you are," he said. "This is in the nature of a command performance. And there's a condition. No questions. Not until we've seen what I have to show you. Agreed?"
One by one, we ghosted through the black communities to the south of the city's heart. Summerhill. People's Town. Joyland. The desolation and poverty of these small communities seemed to me as unredeemed as they were uniform. I could not tell where one left off and the other picked up. But Ben knew. He pointed them out by name as we passed. Glenn drove us through Mechanicsville and Pittsburgh. We skirted the odd, half-familiar little linear enclave of Cabbage Town, which, though desperately poor as the other neighborhoods, was relentlessly all white, and the great crouching jumble of Fulton Bag and Cotton that brooded over it, and then, just beyond it, Glenn Pickens turned down into another little neighborhood and stopped the Lincoln.
"We'll walk from here," Ben said. "Better wrap that scarf around your head and take a gulp of brandy. We got a ways to go and the wind's picking up."
"Where are we?" I said. I had never been this far east before, never ventured beyond the part of Cabbage Town that I could see from our family plot on its myrtle-shaded hill in Oakland Cemetery. This was literally the back of the moon to me.
"It's called Pump House Hill," Ben said. "The only water up in here used to be an old public hand pump on the top of that hill yonder. If you wanted to wash or drink or flush or douse your fire, you toted water from that pump."
"Most people up here still do," Glenn Pickens said.
We walked down the first street in Pump House Hill. The tiny houses were all decades older and in far worse repair than in the other neighborhoods, some without whole roofs, most without one or more window panes, all made of unpainted, rotting, green-scummed wood. Virtually no electric lights burned here, though light poles and power lines yawned and drooped, and few of the chimneys had smoke coming from them. In Pump House Hill, I saw no people, not even the old. The unpaved street was thick with filth and unspeakable things. I was, for the first time that day, glad of the sub-freezing temperatures. The stench would have been unbearable if the excrement that lay clotted in ditches and under windows had not been frozen. At front and side doors, frozen garbage and refuse and piles of frozen, rotted vegetables lay where they had been tossed. I saw several newly dead dogs and cats, not crushed by automobiles, but simply lying stiff and banal and hopeless, as if they had fallen and frozen to death in the night. Once I stumbled and caught onto Ben Cameron's arm and looked down to see what I'd stepped on. It was the crushed and frozen carcass of a rat the size of a small fox terrier. I felt the gorge rise, thick and sour in my throat. "Is there anyone down here? Does anybody live here?" I said. I had seen no one literally since we started out from the Lincoln. I realized that I had spoken hopefully.
"Oh, yeah," Glenn Pickens said. "Lots of folks live here. They're all inside in bed."
"Bed?" I said stupidly.
"Yeah, bed," he said. "You've heard of bed? Where the folks up here go to keep warm when they can't pay the electric or gas bill and they can't find firewood. You can always pile on another dog or young'un."
When we got back to the Lincoln, I was shaking with cold and shock. Under the shock, far down, was a profound anger. "Why'd you take me up there?" I said to Ben. He poured brandy into my coffee and handed it to me. He looked for a long time into my face, his gray eyes opaque.
"I thought you ought to see it firsthand," he said. "Your family owns it."
The wave of revulsion and rage that swept me then knocked me literally against the back seat of the car.
"I don't believe you," I said. "My parents, they couldn't possibly know it was like this. They can't. They wouldn't..."
"They can, and they do," Ben said, and I knew that he was telling me the truth.
"Well, your father does anyway," Ben went on. "He has for years, because I've been after him that long to clean it up, and so have the others. I can only assume Olivia doesn't know. I don't believe she would permit it."
"Shep, I've known your father all my life. His backing made my campaign possible, and I owe him in ways you'll probably never know about. But I swear, I'd have him in court over this if it weren't for Miss Olivia. I grew up playing with her when we visited in Griffin. Our families have been friends for decades, so I really haven't pushed this. Now, though, your dad is out of the picture, and you're here, and it's a different ball game. It can't wait any longer. Glenn says there's really bad feeling down here, and it's getting worse. And with things shaping up the way they are around the South between the races, this has got to be remedied, and remedied quick. It could go up just any time."
"I really didn't know," I said to Glenn Pickens.
"I didn't figure you did, Shep," Glenn said. His face was closed. "But you do now."
My mother looked up from the hand of solitaire she had laid out on her writing desk. She did not speak, but watched me attentively while I shouted and screamed there in a pool of honeyed afternoon sunlight.
"It has never been your father's property," she said calmly. "It is mine and always has been. My daddy left it all to me, every bit, and said it would be my annuity, and I should just sit and let the money pour in and never put a penny of capital into it, and that's just what I've done. Your father would have sunk half our assets into it long ago, but I've always remembered what Daddy said, and I would never sign it over to him or let him pour the money that will soon be yours down that awful rat hole. And don't get haughty with me, my dear son. I don't have any complaints from my tenants. God knows where they'd find lower rents in the entire city."
I had to turn my back on her. I thought of the way she had lived all her life, and what the hopeless misery of those silent, invisible wretches in the cold beds of Pump House Hill had bought her, and how little of that misery would ever penetrate these creamy white walls or her creamy white skin. I thought of what it had bought me. I thought of my gentle patrician grandfather Redwine, and of the trust he had left me, and of what had financed it. My head swam with shame. Without turning back to her, I said, "You will let me authorize our lawyers to get started tomorrow cleaning that place up and getting some decent housing in there, or I will be on a plane out of here before nightfall. I mean it, Mother. As much as it takes, for as long as it takes, or I'm gone. And before God, I'll never set foot in this house or look at your face again." "Sheppy!" "Take your pick, Mother," I said. We fought it savagely back and forth all that afternoon and into the night, but she finally agreed. With any luck at all, the shacks on Pump House Hill could be livable by summer. But it was not a day for luck. In the small hours of that morning, while my mother and I slept, an arsonist's fire howled through Pump House Hill. In the morning, some 100-odd homes were burned to the frozen ground, and 11 people were dead, 7 of them children. Afterward, I heard, the police came to believe that someone who knew that my family owned the property had set the fire, and then alerted the newspapers virtually when the first match was struck, because a reporter was on the telephone to my mother almost before the first fire truck screamed into the inferno, and only minutes later, a cadre of reporters and photographers was on the doorstep of 2500 Peachtree Road. I was wakened by a wild-eyed Shem and stumbled, blinded with sleep and still struggling into my bathrobe, up the path to the house and into the foyer. My mother, bone-white and idiot-faced with terror, stood at bay in her own foyer, her satin and lace robe askew and her black hair wild and witch-like on her shoulders. I was just in time to hear her shriek, "It's not my property! I don't know anything about it. I've never even seen it. My son owns it. I deeded it to him years ago. He's the one who's always looked after it. He's the one. He's the one you ought to be talking to." Her words and my photograph, gaping and blank-eyed in the beautiful foyer of the house on Peachtree Road, were on the front page of every newspaper in the state the next morning and in many out-of-state ones. In the Atlanta Constitution, the headline read, "Fire destroys holdings of Buckhead slumlord," and a subhead under it, "Heir to Buckhead fortune called responsible for slum death trap." I did not speak to my mother again while she lived. Ben Cameron came again that night and brought a bottle of wild turkey with him. He sat down on the deep sofa across from my chair and opened the wild turkey and poured us both a tumblerful. We drank it silently in the firelight, looking at each other.
"Where's your mother?"
he said finally. "She went up to her room early this morning and locked the door," I said. Ben put down his drink and began to speak. By the time he was done, he had told me that, in essence, he and the club were going to let my mother throw me to the wolves. They were all aware of my blamelessness, he said, and were unanimously outraged by her betrayal. I would have the best legal counsel in the South if matters came to that. Several of their own lawyers were at that moment in conference back at the house on Muskogee Avenue. They could, with some assurance, promise me that though there would be an investigation, there would be no grand jury, no more press coverage, and, of course, no criminal charges. But no one was going to come forward and refute my mother's charges. I knew they could do what they promised. Physically, I would be safe. I knew, too, that they would do the rest of it. His grim face told me that. There did not seem anything to say, so I said nothing. "Do you know why we're letting you hang, Shep?" he said. "To save my mother, I guess." "No," he said. "To save us all. You included. All of us out here in Buckhead. To save Buckhead itself and the way of life that's all we know. These are dangerous times. And a false step from any one of us now could lose that way of life in an eye blink. Just up and smoke. It almost went last night. It's going to go soon enough anyway, but if we play things just right, we can hold that day off until you, all of you boys, are ready to take up the reins and our families are safely provided for. It can't get out that one of us right here in Buckhead, one of our women especially,
sat by and knowingly permitted this awful thing. This goddamn race thing just too volatile. Better you, an outsider of sorts. Someone who just might have had the excuse of not being on the spot. It's the worst thing I'll ever do, letting this fiction go on, and it's probably the worst thing this city will ever deal you. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to have to save my people. I'm going to have to spare my city the consequences of this. I still did not say anything. He reached over and laid his hand on my hair and brushed it lightly back from my forehead. I felt warm, weak tears in my throat.
You in every sense but a biological one. You've been my son, he said. God, I wanted you for a son-in-law, as good a man as Charlie is. But I'll take you any way I can get you. Nothing's going to change between us. Not on my part, anyway. I wouldn't blame you if it did on yours. There's something I want you to remember, though, and think about. Your day is still to come, Shep. In 20 years or so, when it's your time, there'll be an entirely new and different set of folks in power in Atlanta. New people who'll never have heard of this fire and couldn't care less if they had. You're not going to lose your place in the sun. Not in the long run. But we are asking you to defer it. I'm asking. We'll be eternally in your debt. The whole city will, though sadly they'll never know it. We'll try to make this up to you somehow. He said nothing more. In a minute or two, he got up and padded out of the room on his rubber soles and closed the door softly behind him. He left the wild turkey on the table between our chairs. It was a measure of Ben Cameron's power and grace that, sitting in my father's library, in the ruins of my life, I saw his point. It was of no particular comfort to me to find that the world did indeed go on, but of course it did. Ben Cameron was inaugurated on January 1st, looking like a slender, steel-crowned king in the winter sunlight as he stood on the steps of City Hall afterward. I could not, now, leave Atlanta for Vermont or New York or anywhere else. I was free to go, of course, but it was somehow unthinkable. I suppose it was an obscure and savage kind of pride that kept me captive in a small house behind my own great one, in hiding from the woman who had betrayed me before her and my entire world. Or perhaps it was depression, the real clinical kind, which saps will and freezes limbs and thickens thought and reaction. On a day in March of booming wind and high sun, when the first of the great spring skies had begun, a man from Southern Bell came in his panel truck with instructions to install a telephone in the summer house. When I asked him who had authorized it, he jerked a thumb backward and said, "Lady in big house yonder." Well, you can tell the lady in the big house yonder that I don't want a telephone, thanks just the same, I said, thinking the lady he referred to was my mother. Well, lady said to tell you not to be an ass, that she was tired of waiting for you to come to her, and she couldn't very well come to you. Said to call her the minute this thing was in. Said you'd know who she was. I did, too. The ass had tipped me off. It was not my mother's style. When the phone was installed, I sat down and dialed Maryvale House. Dorothy Cameron answered on the second ring. Well, she said, the corpse that speaks like a man. Can you walk, too, or is it just the voice that works? Dorothy, you ought to know me well enough to know I don't want this goddamn thing, I said. Appreciate the gesture, though I do. My mother will be on it 14 times a day. She won't if you don't tell her you have it, she said. I told them to bill me for it. It's not charity. I fully intend you to pay me back. Listen, Shep, I want to see you. Over there, I said. No? Well, now would be wonderful, but I don't think I can expect that from Buckhead's only authentic hermit, can I? No, come after dark, if you don't want to see anybody, and let yourself in the sun porch door. Ben will be downtown at a meeting tonight. I don't know, Dorothy, I began. The thought of leaving the summer house suddenly panicked me. Get over here, Shep, before you freeze up entirely and really aren't able to leave that pretty little prison of yours, she said curtly, and I said I would. I started out after dark that night. On impulse, I turned toward the big house and began to trot, and jogged past it down the drive to the sidewalk, and soon was loping flat out up Peachtree Road toward Muskogee. When I came crunching up to the side door to the Cameron sun porch, I was soaked through and blowing like a dolphin, but I felt light as a hollowed reed and clean. I hugged Dorothy Cameron in an excess of euphoria, aware all at once how much I had missed her. She poured me a bourbon without asking if I wanted it, and one for herself. We talked of the comings and goings of Buckhead, and of its gossip and eccentricities, and of Ben's hopeful young term in the fast-changing city, and of the red-haired young president with his fingers in the sky as well as the earth, and of the accelerating civil rights movement and Lucy's deepening involvement in it. We talked of gardening and music, and the litter of kittens out in the garage, and the greening trees, and of art and drama and travel. She said ruefully that she and Ben had had to give up a long-dreamed-of trip to Europe that May with more than 100 members of the Atlanta Art Association, because Ben felt that a newly elected mayor shouldn't spend a month during his first year of his administration away from his city. When I was set to leave, Dorothy Cameron did a wonderful thing for me. She took me into their library and showed me 5 large wooden crates sitting there on the old stone floor, and said that they were the diaries and journals her father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had kept from childhood on. 3 complete, lovingly and faithfully detailed patrician lives, bridging more than 200 years and reaching from the Dorsetshire manor house to the warm red earth of Virginia, and then down through the Carolinas to finally Atlanta. "It's an idea I had," she said. "I know how you love pure research, and I know what a gifted writer you are. And I know, too, that to save your soul and sanity, you need some real work to do, something valuable. So I'm going to give you my family, instead of dumping them on the Historical Society. I'm not just being conceited, Shep. It strikes me that my family is almost laughably, prototypically Georgian. The complete Georgian, sort of. From England via Virginia and the Carolinas, and on down into Georgia and here. We were one of the few relatively educated and well-born families to migrate to the colonies. You have a huge work of history and sociology here, all bound together by blood ties and in the words of the men who lived it. I think you ought to write it. I think you could do a splendid job of it. Would you like to try?" The Complete Georgian was born that night, and Dorothy was right. I fell in love with the gifted, ornery, eccentric men who were clamoring and jostling to get off those crumbling pages. And the liberation of them did indeed, many times over, save my sanity and my soul. Dorothy Cameron gave me that evening the next quarter century of my life. I had a sense that spring that I was slowly and imperceptibly fashioning a life for myself as well as an order for those other lives. In early May, my mother left with 100-odd members of the Atlanta Art Association for her month-long tour of the galleries and museums of Europe. On the first Sunday morning in June, I heard my bedroom door open and a soft voice call, "Shep?" Even with my eyes closed, even half submerged in sleep, I knew the voice was Sarah's, but I was not surprised. In that half-lit world where all ambiguities can be rationalized, I felt only a deep, sweet contentment at the rightness of Sarah's voice calling me out of sleep. I felt her weight as she sat down on the edge of my bed and was reaching for her, eyes still closed, when she said again, "Shep," and this time something in her voice snapped my lids up. At first I thought she had come to tell me of some terrible thing that had happened to Charlie or her soon-to-be-born baby, for her face was so swollen and distorted from crying that I could scarcely recognize her. "Has something happened to Charlie?" I said. "No, it's... Shep, Daddy just got a call. Your mother's plane. It crashed, Shep. It crashed on takeoff at Orly, and I'm afraid they're all gone." She dropped her face into her hands and wept. "I'm sorry. I came over here to tell you because I didn't want you to hear it by yourself on the radio or when some reporter calls." "All gone," I said stupidly. "That's absurd, Sarah. It has to be a mistake. There were too many of them."
More than 100. You and I knew all of them. That was Buckhead, Sarah. Those were the people we've known all our lives. 106 of them, she said.
After she left, I simply sat there. The telephone rang, and I lifted it and laid the receiver on the table. I got up and walked on reedy, wavering legs over to the radio and switched it on. I sat there a long time while the news from France swelled and grew like a monstrous lily. The street in front of City Hall was deserted, but the flags already hung at half-staff, and when I climbed the curving, shallow marble stairs to Ben Cameron's office on the second floor, the crowd spilled out into the corridor. Ben Cameron leaned against his desk, a telephone to his ear and one in his hand. He looked up and saw me and paused a moment in his conversation, and then lifted the receiver and motioned me into a chair and went on talking. Finally, Ben put the phone down and came around the desk and hugged me.
"Is there anything special I can do for you?" he said. "You know I'm going over tonight. I promise you I'll see that she gets home safely."
"I want to go with you, Ben," I said.
"There's no way it's going to be anything but grim," he said. "And there's nothing you can do. There's probably not much even I can do."
"I won't get in the way," I said. "You won't even know I'm there. But I've got to go, Ben." When I got to the Delta Gate that afternoon, Lucy Venable was waiting for me. She sat with a small suitcase beside her, feet firmly together, hands folded in her lap like a good child waiting for her train back to school. Her head was bowed, and I could see that her eyes and nose were red, but her face was calm and still. She looked surprisingly well, even rather wonderful. Her blue-black hair was back in its old, glossy raven's wing pageboy, falling forward against her high cheekbones. And she wore a red linen sheath and a red lacquered straw pillbox hat and low-heeled alligator pumps, none of which I'd ever seen before. Several eyes in the crowd at the gate were on her, and coming upon her like this, unexpectedly and without context, I could see why. Lucy looked entirely herself again, awash, somehow, in the invisible fire that used to cling about her.
"You look really wonderful," I said. "Did you come to see me off? Where's Jack?"
"No, I didn't come to see you off. I'm going with you."
We stepped out into the hot morning light of Paris and into a controlled frenzy of official sympathy. After the greetings, which seemed to stretch into sunny infinity, we were taken into the airport to an Air France lounge where the reporters followed us and Ben held a press conference. Lucy did not go with us to the morgues to look at the dead. In the end, she did not even ask to go. Ben had our driver drop her at the excellent and anonymous small hotel near the embassy where rooms were held for us, and she said only, getting out of the car, "Remember, Gibby, we be of one blood." Ben went to all five morgues that afternoon. After the first one, I waited in the limousine. It was not that I was shocked or sickened or near collapse. It was that after the first one, I knew that any more searching of the dead faces was futile. It would not be by sight that they were identified, and it would not be that day or that week or even probably for many weeks. My presence seemed suddenly an unbearably boorish and brutal intrusion. Ben went back to his room. Lucy and I drank through the fabled lure blue of Paris and into its cool, late-falling night. We held hands, but we did not talk much. We did not get drunk. Neither of us mentioned dinner, nor did we speak of what we both knew. That there was nothing more for us in Paris, and that we would arrange the next day to go home. I do not think that either of us felt the trip had been useless. I know that I felt, obscurely but deeply, that some unnamed and unknowable but essential thing had been accomplished. And I have been grateful all the years since that I went, and that Lucy went with me. We both rose from our table at about 9 o'clock and went upstairs to our adjoining rooms. Around midnight, Ben Cameron rapped softly on the door and then pushed it open.
"I just had a call from home," he said. "Sarah had a little girl this afternoon. She and the baby are fine. She wanted me to tell you that they're naming her Olivia Redwine Gentry because she wants your mother's name to go on. She asked me to tell you that."
"Thank you, Ben," I said. Sometime that night, I do not know when, Lucy came into the room and slipped into the bed with me. She was naked, and her body was long and light and silken and cool, and she pressed it around and against and under and over me, and her warm, sweet open mouth was against my face and hair and cheeks and eyelids and nose, and finally over my mouth, so that I sobbed directly into the breath of her, and then, simply and with a deep, deep flowering, she took me inside her, and rocked with me to a beat as old and deep and primal as the world, and was Lucy, was Sarah, was Lucy, was Sarah, was Lucy, was my mother, was Sarah, was Lucy, was the world, was the universe. And all that I had not felt budded and bloomed and swelled and burst loose and roared through me, and she took it into herself, and I was freed. We flew home to Atlanta the next day, and we did not speak of that night directly, then or ever. When she told me 3 months later that she was pregnant, and I said, Lucy, is it... She only shook her head. I don't know, she said. I honestly and truly don't know and never will, Gibby. It could just as easily be Jack's. And if it isn't, he'll never know it. But when, in March of 1963, her daughter was born in Piedmont Hospital, in the middle of a 3-day ice storm, and I asked the baby's name, there was something more than pride and love for that tiny, perfect girl child in her luminous blue eyes when she said, Mallory. Her name is Mallory Bondurant Venable. From the very beginning, Lucy's bond with her daughter was an extraordinary thing. I did not imagine it. Everyone spoke of it. Jack, leaning back exultantly in his chair in the summer house living room on the night of Mallory's birth, said, It's like looking at 2 mirror images facing each other, or twins of some kind. Those identical blue eyes staring at each other with such intensity you can almost see the sparks jumping between them, and the sounds the baby makes when Lucy talks to her. It's like she understands and talks back. Lucy says she does. I swear to God, Shep, I love my boys, of course I do, but I never felt anything quite like the feeling I have for that little girl. It's almost out of the same piece of what I feel for Lucy. Lucy's feverish happiness shimmered on unabated until the day that Jack was to come and take her and Mallory home. And on that morning, she awoke already in the grip of a full-blown depression that bordered on catatonia. Luce, I said, come on, Luce. It's Gibby. Talk to me. Her cracked lips made the shape of my name, Gibby. And then she said in a dry whisper, I never saw the trees so pretty. October really is the best month, isn't it? I felt ice form along my spine. It's March 1963, and you have a new little girl, and it's time now to cut this out and take her home with Jack, I said too loudly. I don't know any Jack, she said in a frail, fretful child's whimper. I don't have any stupid little girl. Gibby, take me home. I want my daddy. I want to go home.
Lucy recovered from what the doctor described as a classic postpartum psychosis and resumed her work for the civil rights movement. Though Lucy's fragile emotional state required more and more of his attention, Shep continued to work on The Complete Georgian. He knew Lucy was making a disastrous mistake when she quit Damascus House and took a job with South, a little foundation-funded ultra-liberal journal which put her, as she said, far more into the thick of things in the movement. She was soon traveling all over the South, researching articles, participating in demonstrations, and getting arrested. Her travels took her away from Mallory and Jack for days at a time. Shep saw that her commitment had veered into obsession. When Martin Luther King was killed, Lucy had such a severe breakdown she had to be hospitalized. When Shep brought 5-year-old Mallory to see her, Lucy bore the scar of shock treatments on her temples.
Mallory put her arms around her mother. She whispered into Lucy's dreadful hair.
Mama, I want you to come home. I'll be a good girl if you'll just come home. I won't ever be bad anymore. I'll take care of you, Mama. I'll be the mommy all the time, and you can be the little girl.
That's right, Lucy said, smiling happily. You be the mommy, and I'll be the little girl. Even through the great rushing wind of shock and rage in my head, I wondered how many times Mallory had heard those words, and how deeply the conviction went that Lucy's illness and incarceration were her fault. Beside me, Jack Venable cursed in a defeated monotone.
"What's happening, Luce?" I said.
"Jack! Gibby!" she cried. "Stick it in your ear!"
We looked at her. She laughed mightily.
"Stick it in your ear, you bastards!" she sang. "Stick it in your ear!"
And she disengaged her hand from Jack's and put her finger into her ear.
"I think she picked it up from one of the other guests," the attendant said. "We don't think it means anything, but she loves it. Sometimes the only way we can get her to take her medication or go to bed is to play stick in your ear with her. Works every time, so we don't knock it."
"No," Jack said. "If that's what it takes, I'll go around with my finger in my ear for the rest of my life." His face was bleached, and he had aged years in the days of her hospitalization. But the look he gave Lucy was still heavy with the freight of his first dazzled love for her.
"Stick in your ear, Jack,"
Lucy chimed. He put his forefinger into his ear and smiled, and she laughed and clapped her hands. The dull drug haze seemed to lift with her laughter. She shook her head slightly. The mad rictus became her old smile. Mallory crept close to her, and Lucy hugged her and reached up and kissed my cheek and looked into our faces one by one.
"I've been away a long time," she said. "I'd really like to come home now."
She came home at the end of June and stayed there, content, under the kiss of the tranquilizer and the benison of the new antidepressant, to read and garden and watch television and sleep. South gave her a leave of absence with half pay, which was hardly a drop in the bucket in the light of the staggering debt her illness had incurred, but made her feel as if she was contributing something to the household. I knew that Jack was near distraction with worries about money and Lucy's emotional state, but he would not talk to me about either, and refused my offer of a loan so tersely that I did not offer again. He took a second job teaching accounting 3 nights a week at one of our dim, perfunctory local junior colleges, and soon was spending only the few hours after his classes and weekends, during which he slept most of the time at his farm. Lucy was strangely blithe about it. More than once I started to pull her up short when she spoke jeeringly of his being away so much she almost thought he had a woman on the side. I could not believe she'd forgotten why he took the extra work in the first place. Then I would remember the sheer horsepower of the drugs boiling through her bloodstream and hold my tongue. Lucy was a long way from being her old self in those days, though she was fey and dreaming and indolent and seemed happy.
But despite the tranquil periods, Lucy began a free fall into madness and alcoholism. She began going to bed with strange men, calling Jack frantically to rescue her from dingy motel rooms. At first, Jack did go and bring her home, but eventually, sickened and exhausted, he left the job to Shep. Jack, Shep, and Mallory, now 11 years old, had guardedly high hopes for the progress Lucy was making with Faith Farr, her most recent psychiatrist, a wry, warm-voiced woman who had wanted to try her on lithium and a new kind of therapy called cognitive. But Mallory, no longer an unquestioning child, began to seek answers. Real answers.
The week after Christmas, before she turned 12, she said from the rug in front of the fire where she was listening to Jimi Hendrix on her headphones while I read Walker Percy, "Why does Mother go to all those motel rooms?" She did not look up at me as she said it, and though her voice was her own, low and sweet, I could see the dull red creeping up the back of her neck. "Dear Jesus, help me now," I thought in pure panic. "I think you ought to ask your daddy about that," I said, trying to keep my voice casual. "He'd probably rather talk to you about it than have me doing it."
"I've already asked Jack," she said. "He said it wasn't anything for me to worry about and to put it out of my mind. It's Mother's problem," he said, "not mine. But that's just crap, Shep."
"Mallory, it's not anything so bad. It's just... I don't..."
"Oh, Shep, I know she screws men,"
she said angrily, turning finally to look at me. Her eyes were terrible, bottomless pools of pain.
"I know she fucks her brains out with men she never saw before. When Jack wouldn't talk to me, I asked the shrink and she told me. What I guess I mean is why? Why does she have to do that? Why isn't Jack enough? Why aren't I?"
"She isn't herself when she does it," I began.
"Mama told me once that she had the first sick spell right after I was born," she said neutrally,
and I could only think, over the red roaring in my ears, I would like to kill you for that, Lucy. I truly would.
Well, she was wrong, I said evenly. She had some small spells, I guess you'd call them, when she was in college and right after. Maybe she doesn't remember them, but I do. So it couldn't have been you that caused them.
Dr. Farr said it was a way of looking for her father. My grandfather, she said.
The tears still ran, but the awful rigidity had gone out of her shoulders, and she slumped against my knees. I think she's right, I said.
Well, then, what I really want to know is, did she want to do that with her father? I mean, are you supposed to want to, you know, with your father? Or are you not supposed to, and it makes you crazy to want to, or what?
Has she ever said anything about that to you?
Oh, no. No, I just wondered. I mean, if she was looking for her father with all those men, and that was what she did with them, was that what she wanted to do with him all along?
The truth of it was so absurd and shining and whole that I wanted to laugh aloud. I don't know, I said. I really don't. I doubt if she does either. It could be. She sat leaning against my knees for a long time there in the firelight.
It's really awful, isn't it? The whole sex thing, she said.
It can be, I said. It can be pretty awful indeed. On the other hand, it can be pretty terrific. It all depends on a lot of things. Who you do it with, mainly. Lucy stayed in the new hospital, with periodic visits home, for almost a year and a half. Jack was still working two jobs and drinking and dozing when he came home, and his waking time with Mallory must have shrunk to a matter of an hour or less a day. A month or so before Lucy was finally scheduled to be discharged, I caught up with Faith Farr, her therapist, in the snack bar at the hospital and asked for an overview of Lucy's condition and a prognosis. She did not want to give it to me, but in the end she did. Understand that I'm talking to you strictly for Mallory's sake and no other reason, Shep, she said, blowing on her steaming coffee. You've really got no business knowing anything about Lucy. It's her business and Jack's and Mallory's, not yours. I think the interdependency between you and Lucy is unhealthy as hell, and it's one of the main things I hope to help her break. It isn't all that good for you, and it's dangerous for her. I might even go so far as to say that it's helped her get and stay sick. God almighty, Faith. There's been times that I was literally all she had, I exploded. What should I have done, walked away from her? And besides, I'm damn well not dependent on her. The hell you're not, she said calmly. And as for walking away from her, yes, that's just what you should have done. It isn't true that you were all she had. She had herself, but she's never learned to use it. That's what we've been working on like two mules on a sugarcane plantation for the past year and a half. She's coming along with it. She might even make it if you let her walk by herself, you and Jack and, yes, even little Mallory. I'm going to talk to them about this before she goes home. Do you see any signs of damage in Mallory? I said. I'm worried about her having so few friends and sticking around that house waiting on Jack and Lucy when she's home. And I'm worried as hell about the way she feels about sex. She's really afraid of it. She hates the very thought of it.
I didn't know that, though I'm not surprised, Faith said. It's too early to tell if it's serious, I think. Part of it could be her age, and then you can understand why she'd feel that way with her mother in and out of all those beds.
She's already hit on the fact that Lucy, in some entirely unconscious way, was trying to screw her father. Literally, I mean. The only thing she didn't understand was why. I must admit, I don't either, I said.
Well, a well-fucked man is not so quick to hit the road, Shep, Faith grinned. That's what this whole thing with Lucy is about, of course. Loss and fear of loss. It feels to her that all losses are a replay of that first awful one, her father. She knows better now, but the gut is not long on intellectual knowledge. Changing her reactions to loss and her fear of it is going to be a long, long road.
Loss, I said, old pictures slipping into my mind.
Think back, she said. Whenever she's lost something valuable to her, or thought she had, she's gone into one of these things. Alcohol is the ignition switch, but it isn't the engine. It only gets her to where the loss doesn't hurt so much. The first one, after Mallory was born, she lost her status as a child to be cared for to her own child. And when John Kennedy and Martin Luther King died, she lost two classic father figures.
And all the other times, when there didn't seem to be anything to trigger it, I said,
loss, as surely as I sit here. Jack, for certain, changing before her eyes from the stable, vital, older man, the father figure, to a passive, aggressive child himself, waited on by a child, unwilling to come to those motels and get her out of the messes she got herself in. You did that, too. Over and over, she tried to get him to take care of her by provoking him with the booze and the men in the motels. And when he wouldn't, the loss was underscored again.
The next day, I called Charlie Gentry and asked if I could come over and see him about a financial matter, and ended up accepting his insistent offer of dinner first with him and Sarah. And on Thursday night of that week, I went to the little house of Sarah and Charlie Gentry for the first time in more than a decade.
This is number one in the series, Sarah said afterwards, crinkling the great golden amber eyes at me.
Next one on me, I said. Anywhere you say.
I'm going to clear away and you all can get on with your business.
I followed Charlie down into the cramped little pine-paneled den he had fashioned for himself in the basement. He switched on the overhead light, and I laughed entirely spontaneously.
Oh, I know, he said, grinning. Sarah says it looks like a Civil War toy store for big kids.
It did, and worse. Every surface in the room was covered with the Civil War artifacts and relics that had so beguiled Charlie since he was a boy. He prodded a large wooden crate in the middle of the floor with a sneakered toe.
A box of stuff I bought sight unseen from a collector in Louisiana. I know his reputation, though. Shells mainly, I think. These would be 40-millimeter mortar shells I used in one of the big battles, probably Vicksburg. Did you know the mortars were invented during the Civil War?
No, I said, eyeing the box.
They're not live, of course.
Of course not, he laughed.
Relicers are fanatics about that. Come on and sit down. It's not going to explode. You said something about a trust for Mallory?
I told him what I wanted, and he listened, nodding thoughtfully.
No, I can do that, sure, he said. I'll get on it first thing this weekend. You can sign it Monday if you like.
He closed the legal pad and got up from his desk chair, stretching.
Sarah will be down in a minute with some coffee, he said. Stay in there, son, and let's open my new toys.
I looked at him in the lamplight, stooped a little, solid, rumpled, sweet-faced, his head turned to listen up the stairs for the sound of Sarah, who was his wife and his love and his life. I wanted to hug him suddenly. I knew that I would not stay. They saw me off together, arms around each other's waists, waving and calling out plans for our next meeting, and then snapped off the light over the front door and moved out of my range of vision. It was the last time I ever saw Charlie Gentry. Before I reached Peachtree Road in the thick, still summer night, Charlie pried open the package from the careful collector in Louisiana and lifted out the dead mortar shell that was not, after all, dead, and in a blinding white moment, all that was Charlie Gentry, glasses and bald spot and paunch and dark, sweet eyes and great, loving heart, was gone into the ringing air of the little house where he had lived with Sarah.
3 years later, Mallory Bundurant Venable enrolled in Wellesley. Shep missed her terribly that first fall, and when she cut her Christmas visit short because she was meeting friends in Stowe, Shep was desolated by loneliness. Deeply depressed, he made a drink and put Ella Fitzgerald on the stereo.
Until Sarah Cameron appeared in the door of the summer house, I did not even realize that it was New Year's Eve.
It's you, I said witlessly. It is. It surely is, she said. Happy New Year, Shep.
What are you doing here all dressed up?
I went to that awful party the club has every year, and it was a mistake. I realized that if I stayed an hour longer, I was going to have to kiss about 20 drunk people I loathe. So I pinched a bottle of champagne from a tray and came over here to wish you Happy New Year. And, her voice broke into a near-operatic tremolo, and to seduce you, do you think one bottle will do it?
She laughed. And I realized with a remote shock that she was not a little drunk.
Shep?
Yes?
Do you remember that first New Year's Eve you were home from Princeton and we went to Hart's?
and it snowed, and we sat in the bay window looking over Peachtree Street and watched it come down and drank Pattinger Blanc de Blanc.
Yes, I said, I remember.
It was the last really, really good New Year's Eve I can remember, she said.
Me too, I said.
Let's do it again, she said, and fished the bottle from the sofa beside her and held it up. It was Pattinger. The black ice lock in my heart stirred a little, ponderously and far, far down.
Let's do, I said. I got a couple of stemmed glasses from the kitchen and opened the champagne while she watched. It made a wonderful festive whoosh and fountained all over the hearth. I handed her one and glanced at the clock on the mantel over the fireplace. 11:40.
Happy New Year, Sarah, I said. Happy New Year, Shep.
We drank. We drank again. We finished the bottle of Pattinger in 7 minutes flat. We did not speak in all that time. When we both opened our mouths to do so at once and stopped and laughed and began again, I suddenly realized that I could not feel my lips and said, God, I think I've sat here and gotten drunk as a skunk.
Oh, I'm so glad, Sarah said. I don't think I could have done it otherwise.
Done what?
Seduced you. That really is what I came for.
Can you bear to do that, I said. Can you, after all those years and what I did to you and what I've turned into? Can you, Sarah?
I can't bear not to, she said. I can't bear not to. I've missed you for almost 20 years.
I stood up, very slowly, my legs unsteady under me, my heart starting a long, dragging, heaving tattoo. I held out my arms to her. I had no idea on earth what I was going to do next.
Then come here, Sarah Cameron, I said. Come here and seduce me for New Year's Eve.
She moved against me, pressing her body against mine, moving and moving, moving to the beat of the music and the rhythm of her blood, moving, moving. She arched her back and scrubbed her breasts into my chest. Her face was in its old spot in the hollow of my neck, and I could feel the wetness of tears and the rush of breath as she murmured words I could not hear. Soft, crooning words of loss and yearning and old, old love. My arms went around her automatically, and my hands found the smooth, warm hollow in the small of her back and pulled her into my groin. As if they had life independent of me, they pulled the panties down on her hips, and still moving against me, she wriggled them down and stepped out of them. The telephone rang across the room. I knew without a shading of a doubt, without a silvery hair of uncertainty, who it was. Even as I rocked and plunged, liberation from the blackness and the aloneness of 2 decades gathering inexorably in the starved growing, I knew. My pounding heart knew. My ragged breath knew. My penis knew, and wilted in despair at the knowledge. I lay still atop Sarah, eyes closed, flaccid and finished, desolation and ending, bitter in my mouth. Sarah knew, too. She was out from under me with one smooth, violent movement, utterly and icily white, eyes blinded and unfocused. She was back in the satin dress and the silver sandals, with the coat clutched around her before I could sit up, and she did not speak until she was at the door of the summer house. I looked across the room at her. She looked, in that moment, as old as Dorothy Cameron. Older. She looked dead, like an animated corpse come to call on the remorseless living in her mother's old mink coat.
I will not bother you again, she said. I forgot. I truly forgot. But I won't again.
As she turned to go, the bells of St. Philip's Church, just up Peachtree Road, began to peal crazily through the wrecked night. Sarah turned back to me.
I wish, she said conversationally, that Red Chastain had killed her when he had the chance.
And she was gone into the first pealing moments of a new year. The phone began ringing again, even as the door slammed. I let it ring 10 or 15 times, and then I plodded heavily over and picked up the receiver.
Hey, Gibby, she said.
Pause. Deep, shuddering draw of cigarette.
It's Lucy, honey. Happy New Year!
At her graduation from Wellesley, Mallory introduced Shep to the man she would marry, Peter Hopkins Dallet, a young architect recently graduated from Yale. They planned a small wedding in Peter's hometown in Maine, attended only by his immediate family. Shep agreed with Mallory that Lucy should not attend the wedding. No matter how strong she looked, no matter how recovered she seemed, both of them knew that she could not endure the event she could only view as the final loss of her daughter. However, Lucy surprised Shep and Jack by the depth and calm she displayed on hearing the news. She even agreed philosophically that she should not attend the wedding.
3 weeks later, on the first Saturday night in October, the shrilling of the telephone brought me out of a deep, still sleep.
Gibby, it's Lucy, honey.
The rich, slow voice sang with the honey of the old madness.
Gibby, did you know Mallory was getting married next weekend?
Lucy said in a pouting child's voice. Well, yes, I did, Luce, I said. So did you. Remember I told you 2 or 3 weekends ago? We talked about it a long time.
Well, you obviously told somebody else besides Mallory's mother, because it wasn't me. I didn't hear a word about it until Jack Venable just happened to mention it tonight on his 40 millionth scotch. I'm real mad at him. You too, if you knew and wouldn't tell me.
I did tell you, sweetie, I said. I wouldn't not tell you. You said you thought it was wonderful, and you agreed that none of us should go because Peter's family is so poorly off, and that you'd be very happy to see them when they came home after the wedding. We were awfully proud of the way you took it.
I took it, schmook it, Lucy said in fretful annoyance. You got the wrong lady, Tutch. I don't think it's fucking wonderful at all. That baby isn't old enough to get married. She hasn't even talked to me about it. I could tell her a thing or two about marriage. I don't know any fucking Peter in fucking Maine. I fucking well did not agree we shouldn't go. Of course I'm going. In fact, that's why I called you. I want you to come out here and get me and take me to the airport. I'm almost packed. No thanks to Jack Venable, I might add. He absolutely refused to take me. Got awfully abusive about it, Gibby.
Put Jack on the phone, Luce, I said neutrally. Is he awake? There was a long pause, and then she laughed.
No, she said gaily. I don't think you could say he's awake. In fact, I'm fairly sure the son of a bitch is dead. I just shot him in the head with that old gun of his. Now take me to my own baby's wedding, Jesus!
She had, in her madness, told so many lies about Jack's abuse of her that my first instinct was to hang up on her. But the eerie finger of ice along my spine would not let me do that. Are you telling me the truth, Lucy? I asked.
Oh, yes, she said. He's bleeding like anything. It's a real mess. That's another reason I want you to come on out of here, Gibby. I can't clean this up by myself.
Lucy, I'm going to come on out there as soon as I can, I said. Tell you what you do. You get dressed, put on some coffee, and then you sit down and wait for me. Can you do that?
Well, of course I can do that, silly, she sang. I'm not paralyzed. You'll take me then?
I'll take you, I said.
Oh, Gibby, I could always count on you.
Lucy had not been lying. She waited for me, sitting in her accustomed chair with feet demurely together and hands clasped in her lap. A battered fiberglass suitcase sat on the floor beside her, closed and tagged. She wore short white cotton gloves, but her hair was wild, and on her feet she wore soiled scuffs. Her legs were bare, and they were dappled with dark dried blood to the knee. More blood had dried in a swooping spatter across her cheek and on one forearm. Above the rusty blood, her blue eyes danced. She dimpled, but did not speak. Her eyes swung from me across the room. My own eyes followed them with a monstrous, dragging effort. I could not flinch. I could not back away. Jack Venable lay on the spavined old sofa across from Lucy. He seemed immaculate from where I stood, but the blood that had burst from the ruined temple had soaked through the cushion beneath it and spilled in a thin stream down the sofa skirt onto the old liver-colored rug, and puddled there, looking for all the world like black cherry jello, only half congealed.
Lucy, what is going to become of you now? What on earth will happen to you? I can't fix this. This can't be fixed. Who's going to take care of you now?
Why, you will, Gibby, she said. You can, too, fix it. You know you can. And Mallory?
Mallory will come.
my best boyfriend and our beautiful, beautiful daughter. You knew that, of course, didn't you? That she was our daughter? Of course you did. We'd be of one blood, we three. So you both have to take care of me, you see. Call Mallory, Gibby. Mallory will come.
I looked up at the sweet, mad smile and realized that I had no idea whether or not she was lying about Mallory, and would never know. Mallory. Mallory, yes, Mallory would come. Like a fierce, beautiful young hawk circling higher and higher, only to heed finally the falconer's cry and plummet in beauty and mortal peril straight into the snare, Mallory would come.
And me, I thought, yes. As long as Lucy lives, God help me, I will come too. I will come.
I saw us, far back in my ringing head, going on forever, the three of us, locked in a crazy troika of loss and blood and waste and madness. Forever. Forever. I rose to my knees as stiffly as an old, ill man and took the gun from Lucy's lap and pressed it into her hands. I closed them around it. They were rough and hot, even against the chill of the heavy steel. They trembled like the throat of a singing bird. I looked into her face, and she smiled at me again. It was a good child's smile, sweet and simple. Above it, her eyes shone blue, blue, the extraordinary light-drowned eyes of that doomed child who had stood in the foyer of the house on Peachtree Road, pinning my heart to my ribs with her very presence, and said in a voice like dark honey,
"Something stinks."
"Stick it in your ear, Luce," I said. She laughed, the old, rich, bawdy, wonderful laugh. She put the dark gun to her ear, still laughing, her blue eyes spilling the healing light of redemption and benediction over me. "Pull the trigger," I said. Lucy did. By 7:30 the evening after the funeral, I stood at the railing of the old iron bridge over the Chattahoochee River where, 30 years ago, Lucy had shouted my shame across a spring sky before the assembled pinks and gels of Atlanta. Through the bubble of suspended silence that had wrapped me for the past 2 days, I was suddenly aware of the low slanting sun on my head and face, and the little twilight breeze which had sprung up off the water. It was so soft on my arms and chest and face, though the sharp bones of winter lay just below the surface. I wore jogging shorts and no shirt and was barefoot, for I was going on a very long journey, and I wanted nothing about me to snag upon the wind of my leaving. I was neither happy nor unhappy, only profoundly aware that I and the world around me were totally stopped and still, frozen on some great axis, and that I did not know or care if either I or it would start forward again. The pale blue arch of the evening sky was reflected perfectly and wholly in the water far below me, just as it had been on that spring day so long ago. I stood for a while, thinking of nothing at all, and then climbed up onto the railing and looked down at the water. It had been a wet summer, and the river was high and running full, but that was down deep. The skin of it was silken and whole. As it had on that other day, the sky wheeled sickly above and below me, and I closed my eyes against the vertigo. From far below and out of time, I heard distinctly Lucy's silvery, jeering voice,
"Come on, Gibby. Jumper will think you're North Fulton fruitcake. Come on. Mark my trail."
Opening my eyes, I saw below on the willow bank the gleam of white flesh and the fine shape under the wet black hair of narrow, beautiful skull. The very air shivered with her vivid aliveness. I threw back my head and cupped my mouth with my hands and shouted into the wheeling blue emptiness,
"Lucy, Lucy Bondurant, are you listening? Lucy, mark my trail."
Only silence answered. She had gone, leaving me to the emptiness of willows and river. Empty. Empty. My knees sagged and the hopeless nausea rose in my throat. And then another voice also, from far below me, came riding out of our childhood on the little evening wind.
"Shep Bondurant, I mark your trail."
I snapped my head down, space swooping around me. Sarah Cameron Gentry stood below on the weedy approach to the bridge, her red scarf and black hair blowing on the wind. Her cupped hand shielded her eyes from the dazzle of evening light, and even from that distance, I could see that she was laughing. An enormous lightness seized me. Gladness started up in my chest. The world jerked, shifted, flowed forward again like floodwater. The wheeling space around me bellowed joy. I lifted one fist straight up and out in the old black power salute and, borne up on a great gust of laughter, dived into the sky.